Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Rand Wilson, communication coordinator at the AFL-CIO. He's in their organizing department, the Center for Strategic Research. We're going to be talking about the ILWU, the Longshoremen Workers Union out in California, and their victory with the Rite Aid place out there. We've been talking about this for a couple years. Now it seems finally, after years of dedication, commitment, people standing shoulder to shoulder, side by side, we are now seeing some positive results, and we're going to talk to him about that. Also going to talk about here in town, the Rite Aid shareholders meeting is going to be going on at the Harrisburg Hilton, just here in the state capitol. Going to have a bunch of people tomorrow, I guess it is, Jobs with Justice, United Students Against Sweatshops, going to be releasing their joint investor alert tomorrow, a day ahead of the shareholders meeting. And, of course, on Thursday, there are going to be a number of Rite Aid workers from across the country going to be marching on the Harrisburg Hilton to show their support and also to let the shareholders know that somebody's watching. And I guess there are a couple of proposals. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that as well. Also in the first hour, we're going to talk with labor attorney Sandy McNair. He's going to talk about what's going on with Rite Aid and really, the charges that went into this, how difficult this struggle has been over this time frame and the legal back and forth that has gone on there. So that'll be interesting. In the second hour, we're going to talk with Mike Ludwig. He wrote a great piece over at truthout.org, a special investigation on pesticides and politics here in the country. Also, Kerry Axelrod from Walmart Watch going to be here talking about the big Supreme Court decision and what that's going to mean for women workers as we move forward, where that's going to go. Also going to talk about the GOP field, all of the news of the day. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I don't know if you saw this story in the Wall Street Journal. Really grabbed me, and finally somebody out there saying the absolute obvious. Last night I was talking about the benevolent corporation that does not exist, but most of us seem to buy into it. Oh, my employer cares. No, the employer cares about the bottom line. And as we saw in the big collapse of September of 2008, as soon as you couldn't make the employer a profit, you were sent to the curb and sent to the government to collect your unemployment benefits or to collect welfare. And thank goodness they were there, because we would have been in a full-fledged depression had they not been. But this professor, Alan Blinder, he's a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University, also a former chairman of the Federal Reserve. He wrote a great piece talking about the whole Republican movement that seems to buy into this idea that if we cut costs, we cut spending, somehow magically, we're going to create jobs. And, you know, it's really kind of wrongheaded. It's kind of insane. But if you listen to their logic and you think about it, especially when you're talking about taxes, you got John Boehner out there saying, you know, we've seen over the last 30 years that lower marginal tax rates have led to a growing economy, more employment and more people paying taxes. I ask, when? When, John? DeMint, the guy from South Carolina, we also need to just cut that top marginal tax rate for individuals and corporations so we can be more competitive. And companies can look way out in the future and know that they've got competitive tax rates. I'm sorry, I'm kind of missing that. Budget Chairman Paul Ryan, you know, Mr. Wedgie himself, the economics profession has already been clear about this. Higher marginal tax rates create a drag on economic growth. And I go, really? Is that how it is? Because, you know, when I look back to the 50s and you look at the top marginal tax rate somewhere over 90%, 1953, 92%, we had growth in the 50s of 4%. Now, these last 8 years, we've had less than half of that. So I'm kind of missing this whole argument that lower taxes creates jobs, because it hasn't happened. And like when Bush said it himself, you know, we're gonna cut taxes by $550 billion. And hopefully, wish and hope, remember, we're going to create 1 million new jobs. That did not happen. And remember, we lost jobs during the Bush years. And over the last 10 years, over that 1999, the 2009 span, no new jobs. Nothing. Zero. Zip. Nothing. Remember that. So it's interesting to see that this whole argument continues. And what they do is they're talking about this whole push towards cutting government spending. We need to cut, cut, cut. And what that means is we need to cut state employees. We need to cut public sector workers. And we're hearing it. Look at the newspapers. Every article you see, the right has done a masterful job of pushing that frame out there. And really what it is, it's the frame that since they still have health care, since they still make a reasonable living, they shouldn't, because they're not suffering like you and I are, which is ludicrous. Instead of asking the question, how do we raise ourselves up, why do we want to tear others down? But there's this conservative view out there that government's just too big. Too big. And the big question, I guess, that's out there, if we do destroy all of these government jobs and we do stop spending, how is that going to turn around and create jobs in the private sector? We haven't seen that happen. What we have seen is through lower investment, we've seen our roads and bridges crumble. Here in Pennsylvania, we've got a governor who wants to cut $1 billion from education. Just like we have done over the years with our infrastructure, he wants to do that with education. So as our bridges are crumbling, they want our education system to crumble as well. And I ask, how are you going to attract that next industry? How are you going to attract the next Silicon Valley? How are you going to attract the next high-tech industry if you have an education system on the decline? You know, I'm still not getting that. But that seems to be the way we want to be going, and I'm not getting it. And he points out what Krugman talks about, this confidence fairy. And the Republicans throw this out. Well, you know, business needs to have certainty. You know, they need to make sure that they can look down the road, because if they feel certain, they're gonna grow investment and they're gonna spend money. The reality is they've been investing in themselves just fine. They've been doing an awful lot for themselves just fine. They've been creating millions of jobs just fine. Well, they've been creating jobs overseas. And again, that's a whole other discussion about our insane trade policies, but still, they have been doing that. And if you look at this, and this whole argument about cutting spending, this whole argument about smaller, less intrusive government, what does it really mean? Well, what it really means is less economic activity, less people working. Create that desperation class that we've been talking about. And if they can just take us backwards to the good old days when people worked from sun up to sun down, when you didn't have a pension, you didn't have health care, things would be so much better in conservative world. And you look at what, you know, our governor here says, he wants to be like Texas. Gotta be like Texas. Texas has one of the highest uninsured rates, has the highest number of children in poverty, has one of the lowest academic achievement rates, and also has the highest number of minimum wage workers. Is this really what we want Pennsylvania to look like? I don't think so. Now, look, I want the government to spend my dollar wisely. And I think back 32 years ago today. 32 years ago today, Jimmy Carter stood on the roof of the White House and said, you know what? These solar panels that we're putting on the house, a generation from now, this solar heat can either be a curiosity, a museum piece, or it can be a small part of the greatest adventure undertaken by the American people. 32 years ago, he said that. And you look back over the last 32 years and you gotta ask the question, where'd we go wrong? You know, right now, finally, I'm getting solar panels on my house. Happy to be getting them. Thrilled. But if it weren't for a smart investment by our government, if it weren't for tax rebates and tax credits, it would be unaffordable right now. And this is where smart policy, smart investment comes in. And this is why I'm calling the White House to tell them to honor their pledge to put the solar panels up on the White House. I think it would send the positive message that it did back in the 70s when we saw Carter lead the way and we saw millions of homes across the country follow. So the president has said, well, you know, we're committed to it. We'll get to it eventually. Times are tough. You know, we're on our way. So I'm encouraging everyone to give them a call, and maybe we could act like China, where 250 million people take showers every day with hot water that comes off the rooftop panels. You know, those people, those 250 million folks in China, didn't have to build 40 nuclear plants. They were able to do that with the sun and with smart investment. You know, 90% of the houses in Israel right now have rooftop solar panels. You go into Germany, more than 70% of the people there have panels on their home. Why are we not investing in our future? Why are we not looking down the road on how we take advantage of this opportunity? This could create millions of jobs. Well, that's right. Government investment doesn't create jobs. Government policy doesn't do that. That's right. Amazing stuff. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Rand Wilson, communications coordinator at the AFL-CIO, their organizing department, Center for Strategic Research. Right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling against a million women workers at Walmart could add fuel to the union organizing fire at the giant retailer. Jesse Russell reports.
On Monday, the Supreme Court declined to hear a class action lawsuit that alleges the worldwide corporation Walmart had discriminated against women. Justice Anthony Scalia, writing for the majority, said the entire company couldn't be held accountable for what could be the actions of managers not representative of the entire company. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the partial counterposition that while the company shouldn't face damages, the court should have heard the case because there is evidence of systematic sex discrimination. The United Food and Commercial Workers has been seeking to organize Walmart stores in both the United States and Canada, so the union has been following this case closely. Assistant Director Jennifer Stapleton of Making Change at Walmart.
Women at Walmart know that discrimination is real. What we're finding now is that associates are more interested in taking action collectively since the legal system doesn't seem to be the way that it's going to work for them.
Stapleton said her organization is now working with a new Walmart's employee group called Organization United for Respect at Walmart, which hopes to represent workers' interests collectively in order to provide education and improve working conditions.
Rather than waiting on the company or the government or anybody else to sanction their right to have a voice, associates just came together to form one through our Walmart.
If you're in solidarity with workers and you're traveling to Chicago, striking Hyatt workers ask that you don't stay at Hyatt hotels in the Windy City.
Support the boycott not to come inside these hotels if they're not going to treat the workers what their chests do. Our workers are standing up for what's right.
Unite Here workers went on strike against the four Chicago area Hyatt hotels Monday. Will Spain is door captain at one of the Chicago Hyatts. Spain says the main issue is job security.
The Hyatt has added temp workers to work alongside our folks to try to take away their jobs. We need the support from the community. We need support from the religious leaders.
Before striking, the workers bargained with Hyatt for 20 months. Unite Here says Hyatt is owned by billionaires, yet wants to outsource work and impose dangerous conditions on housekeepers. The American Journal of Industrial Medicine found in 2010 that Hyatt housekeepers had the highest injury rates of the five major hotel companies.
They do a 16-room quota a day, and they're beaten down. They can't go home and feed their families at the end of the day.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Again, on Thursday, down here in Harrisburg, it's going to be 9:15 a.m. on the 23rd. We're going to meet in front of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO building, 319 Market Street, to start the march to the Hilton just down the street, to go and talk to the shareholders of Rite Aid, and really, you know, to say, look, you know, folks, cutting our health care is a sick idea, you know, especially when you're a national chain. I mean, again, you know, I look at that guy the other day, robbed a bank just so he could get a little bit of health care. I mean, there's something seriously wrong with that. But anyway, on Thursday, 9:15, we're going to be there. Tomorrow, as I said, Jobs with Justice and United Students Against Sweatshops, they're going to release a joint investor alert to the Rite Aid shareholders. So that ought to be interesting to see what goes on there. But here to talk about the organizing campaign that went on in Lancaster, California, with the ILWU, the International Longshoremen Workers Union, is Rand Wilson. He is also the communications coordinator at the AFL-CIO in Washington, D.C. Rand, thanks for taking time for us, brother.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This campaign in Lancaster, California, five years in the making?
Yes, and a tremendous struggle by over 500 employees at a giant distribution center up in the Antelope Valley, about 75 miles east of Los Angeles, where Rite Aid has its West Coast distribution, where they, you know, the employees sort all of the products that are going to go out to all of the different stores in the West Coast. It's an environment where your work is paced by the machines, by the belts. And the productivity is, you know, they're just constantly on the workers for higher productivity. The conditions in the facility are, you know, vary from extreme cold in the winter to just unbelievably hot working conditions in the summer. And so about 5 years ago, the workers said, hey, we've had enough. And they voted in an NLRB election. They voted to join the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union, which is a very progressive union on the West Coast.
You know, I look at this, and you brought up one of the main points, conditions. The reason people join unions, the reason they wages, hours, conditions. And generally the last 30 years, it's been mostly conditions, you know, unsafe working conditions, health problems, things like that, that force workers into really seeking help from the outside.
Yeah. So, you know, this is our, I think, the fourth Rite Aid meeting where we've had a combination of shareholder activism, where we're using our status as owners of Rite Aid Corporation's stock to gain access to the meeting, and to use that as a venue to present our issues. And so this is the fourth year that we've been taking advantage of this opportunity to talk with the members of the board of directors, to the top executives of the company, and to shareholders about our concerns, whether those concerns are the struggle by the workers in Lancaster, California, or right here in Pennsylvania by thousands of Rite Aid store employees who belong to the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 1776.
Right. You know, and looking at this, you know, I for the past couple of years, we have we've participated in this. And I always wonder, you know, what kind of response do you guys get when you go into these meetings? Because at the end of the day, you know, as I talked about yesterday on the program, this idea that has been put out there by the right wing that there's this benevolent corporation that, you know, cares about us, I don't think exists. I think it's all about the bottom line, and workers need to understand that and form together. And much like capital comes together to form a corporation, workers need to take their capital and merge it together as well to be able to fight back some of the more egregious violations that go on. I'm wondering what kind of response you get at these meetings.
Well, typically at a shareholder meeting, the reaction from shareholders isn't too positive to labor unions. What's interesting about Rite Aid is this company's been so badly managed. It is so mismanaged. And the shareholders are so up in arms that, in fact, they get what we're saying. And so we have actually found that we've gotten a great response from a lot of shareholders, and particularly from some of the institutional shareholders, which have voted our way on Say on Pay, and we hope will be supporting our resolution this year to stop the company's giveaway on their golden parachutes, where they not only give out millions of dollars in these severance plans, but then agree to pay the taxes on them. So we expect that we're going to get a lot of shareholder support. We might not win the proposal, but I think we'll get a good vote, both from the individual shareholders and from some of the institutional shareholders.
You know, when you brought up an interesting point there,
But that's because this company has just been badly managed. And I will say it right now, the board of directors and the top officers of the company have been looting the company for themselves. They have not had shareholder value at the heart of their decision making. They certainly haven't had the customer in their minds, and believe me, they could care two hoots about the employees.
Well, I mean, I think most CEOs and most board of directors, they've got their pockets in mind first and then everybody else. But you brought up an interesting point. And the frame that the right has and the pro-business community has put out there is that unions only care about themselves, when in reality, the unions care about the company and the health of the company. And I go back to Samuel Gompers, who said, you know, if a company doesn't operate at a profit, it should be criminal. Because, look, at the end of the day, if a company's not making money, they can't stay in business, and they can't employ those workers.
That's why we're releasing our investor alert tomorrow, or I should say Jobs with Justice and the United Students Against Sweatshops are releasing this investor alert, because we want to put the investor community on notice that this company can't succeed unless it pulls together the customers, the stockholders, and the employees and their unions pull together to make this company succeed. And Rite Aid thinks that it can cut its way to profitability. They think that they can somehow balance the books on the backs of the employees. They are so deeply mired in debt and mismanagement and disastrous decisions at the top level that is not a strategy for this company to succeed. What they need to do, and I hope they're listening tonight, what management needs to do at Rite Aid is involve the employee and improve the satisfaction of the employee so that we get positive customer satisfaction and bring the customers back into the stores. That's what needs to happen. And that's not going to happen by cutting people's health care benefits and cutting their wages. It's not going to happen by insulting the frontline employee. It's going to happen because they improve the quality of service. They've got to focus on that. We're going to be saying that at the shareholder meeting and at the rally on Thursday.
Well, it's a great position, but corporate America has taken this frame that they can benefit, especially in this economic crisis, that they can benefit and they can line their pockets by stealing from their workers either wages or benefits or you know, worsening conditions somehow to line their pockets and you know, That's the way they've been going. I mean, look at case after case after case. Motts comes to mind, Express Scripts. A number of these cases over the last couple of months were these profitable companies doing exactly what you're saying that Rite Aid is trying to do to dig themselves out of a hole, and it's not working there either.
Well, what's exciting is that we have some good news to report after many years of struggle at the Lancaster warehouse, which is that people stuck together there with the ILWU, with the community groups that were backing them, and they won. They won significant gains in their first contract, a contract that was ratified overwhelmingly just May 12th, I guess that would be a month and a half ago, and where they won fair health insurance rates, job security protections, new productivity standards that they can challenge and negotiate over in terms in using the union's own industrial engineers so that they can have some say over the pace of work, and a right to refuse unsafe or unhealthy working conditions.
That's important.
Yeah,
you know,
very
again,
important.
Again, wages, hours, conditions.
So it's really good news that when people stick together and fight back and stay united, they can win a union agreement and make significant gains and improvements in their wages and working conditions.
Let me ask you this. When was the first election, the first NLRB election? How long ago was that that they said, you know what, we're going to have this election, they voted, and now the contract negotiations began? What was the frame between that time and May 12th when they actually got the first contract?
Well, the election was about 5 years ago, so that would put us into 2006, I guess, 2007, right?
I got to tell you, to me, that highlights a major flaw in our labor law and something that really, I got to be honest, should not happen.
It took so long because the company thought, incorrectly, they thought that they could surface bargain and desert this group and they would go away. But the ILWU had a strategy. And I think it was a very good strategy it really had three major components that would, is a lesson that everybody can learn from. One, they kept the people together in the shop, right? They kept those 550 employees together, and they acted like a union on the job. They stayed strong, they stayed militant, and the ILWU kept organizers and kept assisting that group so that they could fight for their improvements while they were negotiating their first contract. The second thing was that the union involved all of the other Rite Aid workers' unions around the country in supporting their cause. So we had a solidarity strategy to bring everybody together to say, hey, an injury to one is an injury to all. It may sound corny, but it's a slogan that's as true today as it ever was, and we need to go back to that, which is we've got to stick together. If there's a Rite Aid struggle in Cleveland, Ohio, which right now we have 8 stores on strike in Cleveland, Ohio, we need to stick up for one another in the Rite Aid Corporation. If there's workers in Lancaster, California, we need to stick up for them. So what the ILWU, the AFL-CIO, UFCW, the Teamsters, 1199, we've brought everybody together in a coalition of Rite Aid workers, and with that, we've been stronger. And finally, I would say that we didn't want to do it, but eventually we were forced to have a pinpoint boycott of a couple of Rite Aid stores in Southern California, where we used the strength of the ILWU's membership on the docks to what we call strip the scripts. And it was that activity that I think really brought Rite Aid back to the table to finish the agreement.
Well, why would you support somebody who doesn't support you?
Exactly.
I mean, to me, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So it was, but I just want to emphasize how important it was to bring all of the unions in the Rite Aid system together. This is a big company, 4,700 stores, 20 distribution centers in 10 states. I mean, it's a very big company, but everybody pulled together because everybody understood that we needed to win a first contract for those workers in Lancaster, California. It's a tremendous victory.
Well, congratulations on the hard-fought victory. Congratulations moving forward, and I wish you guys nothing but the best. Rand Wilson, communications coordinator at the AFL-CIO, their organizing department's Center for Strategic Research. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts? Back after this.
Watching about the unions again, they have all died away. conservatism. Rick Smith.
David Koch, the right-wing multi-billionaire, likes to pose as a class act. He's thrown around several million bucks, for example, to get a wing of Manhattan's Lincoln Center named for him and to buy a seat on the board of WGBH, Boston's prestigious public television station. These purchases make nice wallpaper for him, but they can't cover up the ugliness at the core of Koch's heart. He's poured a fortune and his very soul into the creation of dozens of political attack groups and corporate fronts to advance his self-serving plutocratic vision of America. Far from a class act, the Koch operation is as crass as they come. One of the crudest arms of his vast and secretive political network is called Americans for Prosperity. It runs all sorts of astroturf campaigns to knock down the prosperity of working families and lift up the power and prosperity of corporate elites, like the Kochs. AFP's Michigan branch recently showed what it's made of in a campaign to kill funding for a new international bridge between Detroit and Canada. Building this bridge would create jobs and ease traffic snarls, but it would compete with a corporate-owned toll bridge, and the Kochs virulently oppose all things public. To stir up public opposition, AFP went into a hard-hit Detroit neighborhood and plastered people's homes with official-looking flyers that declared in bold type, "Eviction Notice." The bogus flyers told homeowners that the State Transportation Agency was prepared to seize their homes to make way for the new bridge. "It was meant to startle people," said AFP's clueless and classless state director, who was perversely proud of the panic his lie had caused in this distressed community. This is Jim Hightower saying, such sensitivity is what has made the Koch name a cuss word all across America.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Pull out the good old union and still been here to twill. Which side are you on?
Well, you know, that's the question. Which side? Which side are you going to be on? Is he going to be on the CEO side or on the workers' side? And I look at our quote of the day from Brandon Reyes, AFL-CIO executive pay analyst. He says, quote, CEOs have been able to profit from the stock market fluctuations. The stock options they received in 2008 have allowed many CEOs to profit for simply getting share prices back up where they were, whereas long-term investors have not seen significant share price appreciation. And, you know, I look at, if you remember Wendell Potter, we had him on the program a couple of times in the past. He's been one of these guys keeping an eye on the health insurers, these big CEOs at the health insurance companies, watching what they're doing with your premiums, you know, that money we pay for health care. Turns out between 2003 and 2010, the five big for-profit health insurers spent more than $64 billion buying their company's shares back off the open market. And according to Potter, United Health recently announced the stock repurchase somewhere around $5.5 billion. And you go, well, what's so big about that? You know, why are they doing this? What's the big deal? Well, it raises their share price, puts more money in their pocket, lines that CEO's pocket. Because remember, their take, their haul, lined to the share price. In 2007, Potter points out that, quote, American companies spent 12% more on repurchasing than they spent on improving their businesses. And in 2010, those heavy five, the healthcare CEOs, averaged almost $15 million in their pocket. And we wonder why someone's willing to go to jail. Wonder why someone's willing to go to jail just to get health care. Kind of just makes you wonder, doesn't it? Amazing, amazing stuff. Anyway, I've got labor attorney Sandy McNair here in the studio with me. He's a labor attorney from the Cleveland area, does some work with the unions out there. I want to talk about the rate aid situation out in Cleveland because, as I understand, like Rand just said, eight places on strike, a whole bunch of shenanigans back and forth. That's why I've asked Sandy to come talk to us. Sandy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, in any of these labor disputes, in any of these strike situations, there are going to be charges back and forth. I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the unfair labor practices, whatever's going on out there in Cleveland right now.
Yeah, just to set the table, the contract expired in April of last year, and we entered into an extension agreement that Rite Aid then pulled in December. And leading up to terminating that extension agreement, we had they gave us a final offer and then engaged in a series of actions that we then filed allegations on with the National Labor Relations Board, found probable cause that Rite Aid engaged in polling, interrogated employees about how they were going to vote, threatened to close stores if employees went on strike, threatened employees with job loss if Rite Aid's contract wasn't ratified, generally undermined our the Local 880's position as the collective bargaining agent, unilaterally changed policy of allowing union representatives access to employees during work time, engaged in direct dealing with employees, unilaterally changed the practice of scheduling front-end bargaining unit members, et cetera, et cetera. For which the board, the region, has issued a complaint. We've then filed new charges since the strike, for which the board has found probable cause as well. We have additional charges pending that are being investigated, and we have even more charges that we'll be bringing forth to the region.
You know, you brought up a bunch of these charges and a lot of things. I don't think most people know that stuff's illegal, because I think what's happened for so long is we've been accustomed to having all those things happen to workers, because I've often said I think the American worker suffers from a form of Stockholm syndrome, to where we've been beaten down for so long we kind of identify with the people who are doing the beatings, which is why I think the right and the Republicans in this country right now are going so crazy over the NLRB decision to move forward against Boeing, because it's been so long since the NLRB has been used to actually enforce the things that you're talking about.
Well, I think you're right. One big problem with the act is, number one, what's the remedy? And is that remedy sufficient that it's going to deter employer conduct? And in all of these allegations, basically the remedy is assuming we win, is basically to post a notice promising not to do it anymore. From my perspective, that does not deter employer conduct. And even if it were, because of the way that the act works, so now we have a complaint filed, then we have to have a trial before an administrative law judge, then the briefs are filed, then the ALJ renders a decision, then exceptions can be taken to that, to the board in Washington, more briefs are filed, the NLRB renders its decision, and that's still not self-executing. If you want to get that final decision, and the employer is recalcitrant and continues to refuse, then you have to go to the Circuit Court of Appeals to get that enforced. That often takes many, 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 many years.
Yeah, and what's happened right now, and I've been seeing story after story of, oh, how poor Boeing is just being beat up for this stuff, and any employer, really, who comes out and blatantly breaks the law, part of me thinks it's for so long we've not enforced the laws, we've not done a very good job of educating workers on what their rights are, that now we're surprised when someone actually stands up and says, you went too far.
Correct. I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, and I've been talking about this for some time, because the Boeing situation, and I don't want to get too far away from what you're here for, but the Boeing situation for me has nothing to do with South Carolina, even though the politicians want to make it about South Carolina. It's about the fact that you have a company who blatantly, for one reason or another, thought emboldened to come out and say publicly that they were retaliating against their workers.
Well, I think that's kind of the fundamental principle. That there is, at least under the Act, there is a rationale and a principle that you cannot retaliate against workers for engaging in clearly protected federal rights. Now, if you took that away from the labor context and asked anybody, well, do you think an employer or anyone ought to be able to retaliate against somebody for exercising their federally protected rights, everybody would say no.
Right.
But then when you start to apply that in a labor context, oftentimes you get a different reaction.
Well, let me ask you this, Sandy McNair. You know, you're looking at the charges of the things that you said there, that the company, you know, did a number of the things that you said, and in a lot of cases end up firing workers. Take it to the step from the Boeing question. Now we're going to actually enforce the laws. We're going to actually hold employers accountable. I think people are surprised.
I think you're right, and again, I think it also goes back to politics, the importance of having a president that will put people on the board that will, in fact, enforce the act as it's written and as it was intended to protect worker rights.
Now, as I understand, the strike was going on there 15 weeks?
Approximately 3 months, yes.
And where are we now with that?
We have 7 stores out on strike. What happened initially is when we went out on strike, we had people at the doors. The employer called the police to move us out to the street, to the sidewalk. We then sent letters to those communities threatening to file a federal court litigation against both those communities and Rite Aid for doing that. Those communities then said it's not our fight. You go get a state court injunction. They got a state court injunction in 2 out of the 3 counties where we have the strike. And then we filed charges over that, saying that it's not for the state courts to determine where we are to picket. That's for the NLRB to decide. The NLRB has, in fact, found probable cause that we are allowed to be on Rite Aid's private property. They have sent Rite Aid what's called a Lowman's Plaza letter, which means that they are to tell Rite Aid to go back to the court and say that the courts no longer have jurisdiction. And actually, today was the last day they had to do that, and I'm not sure if Rite Aid did that or not. So we'll be pursuing that matter if Rite Aid continues to refuse to do what the NLRB has told them to do, and we're obviously in negotiations at the table.
You know, at the end of this, I still go back to the point: workers have the right to organize. And then just talking with you for a couple of minutes, you listen to the hoops that people have to jump through for that right. And I say that there's something wrong about this.
Well, I think certainly it's all kind of skewed to the employer in terms of where the power lies and the difficulty not only of organizing, I mean, the difficulty of maintaining a strike. That this local has put enormous resources towards this strike to make it successful. So, for example, for those that are out on strike, the local is paying their wages as if they were working and is paying their health care to allow them to be able to sustain themselves during this strike.
Wow, that's remarkable. And those are stories that never get out into the media. You never hear those stories out that, you know, this is about community. This is about togetherness. This is about standing together, solidarity.
Right. Right.
Last question. What can we do to help? What can I do to help? What can our listeners do? Encouragement, donations, what? What can we do?
I would simply, people should, what we would ask people to do is to write Stanley, the CEO, and tell them that they're not going to shop at Rite Aid until this strike is over in Cleveland.
That's right. No more shopping at Rite Aid, Brett. No more for you. Sandy McNair, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for the information. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we, the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails. Personally, there are about 135,000 people here in the state of Pennsylvania are happy that they don't live in Wisconsin, I'll tell you that. Because as if you look at it, Wisconsin may become the latest state to not extend their federal unemployment benefits. You know why? Because they got Republicans who are sitting on their hands. They got Republicans who are, well, you know, folks whose extended benefits ran out April 16th, 10,000 people gone off the rolls. Their co-chairman of the Joint Finance Committee, Robin Voss, he argues there are jobs out there, but people are unwilling to take them. Gee, have we heard that before? Have we heard that once before? Maybe a couple times before? Understand that the average unemployment check in Wisconsin is about $360 a week. That's it. That's for a family to live on. Ain't happening. And what I find really, really disheartening is you've got these folks out there, Jake, who just they've got this frame, this right wing frame that there are jobs out there and you're just lazy or the benefits are too generous. $360 a week, I'm sorry, not all that generous.
And what you're doing, if you deprive those who, by the way, have paid in, many of them have maybe for the first time being laid off, and what's missing in this discussion is that $350, you can bet they'll spend every dollar. In other words, it's a stimulus. It's a stimulus to the community because they're going out and they're purchasing the basics of life.
Well, at the end of this, the National Employment Law Project, they came out with a report last month that said for every job opening out there, right now, for every job opening out there, we thought it was 5, according to the National Employment Law Project, 5.6 people are out there, almost 6 people out there looking for a job for every one opening right now. And, you know, you go around the country and you look at all of these states, Arizona, another one. You know, tough luck, buddy. You're on your own, brother. On your own. And, you know, you look at what they're doing in Congress, the Republicans pushing these free trade agreements, saying, well, you know what? You don't need to have that. You don't need to have that trade adjustment assistance in there. We can do that later down the road. And then you find out they've actually got a bill to destroy it completely. And then you wonder.
Well, the sad part about it is these same people who don't want to fund unemployment are then not, they don't want to adequately fund Medicaid for the poor. So you push someone off unemployment, they don't have any money, they're going to go wherever they can get medical assistance and where they can get assistance. if worse comes to worse, they're going to feed their family some way, somehow, and then our society deteriorates, and in some respects it already has.
Or they're going to get health care by robbing a bank for a dollar. You know, I can't get over that. That really sticks in my mind. That this guy was sick. And, you know, when I first read the story, I thought of our friend Ike in South Carolina, you know, who has got some medical problems. I thought of him, and I said, you know what? If I were him, I don't know, man. I don't know. Because, you know, look at this guy and this Verone guy in North Carolina going, you know, I got something going on here. I don't know what it is. I can't afford to go to the doctor. I can't get anything else. I'm going to rob a bank. Just amazing stuff. And you've got a party. You've got a Republican Party who's saying, no, sorry, not going to happen. But what they want more for themselves. And it's, again, pushing these free trade agreements. And, you know, I go back to this. You know, that whole free trade cocktail that they're trying to ram down our throats. The Colombian thing, the South Korean trade agreement, Panama. They want it all, man. And I loved, and I wanted to talk about this yesterday, but I didn't get to it. A guy named John Murphy, Vice President of International Affairs at the International Hit Squad there at the Chamber of Commerce, on their blog Chamber Post, wrote, listen to this. This is just, you know, the logic that goes into just really astounding. He writes, quote, "Today, homicide rates are higher in the United States, 5 per 100,000, than among Colombia's labor union members, 3.4 per 100,000, he says. A resident of the District of Columbia is 7 times more likely to be murdered than a Colombian labor union member. The allegations that labor union members are targeted for assassination today comes from U.S. labor unions, not Colombians." You gotta love that kind of cherry picking. You gotta love it. Well, you're more likely to die in the U.S. In fact, you'd be more likely to have a Colombian union member killed in the United States, according to the Chamber of Commerce. And again, you know, you kind of look at this and you go, what exactly are they talking about? It's about changing the message. Last year, 41 union members were killed. In the entire world, 49 were killed in Colombia. So you had 90 union members killed nationwide, assassinated nationwide, murdered globally, I mean. 49 of them in Colombia, 41 of them in the rest of the world. And they're trying to convince us that, well, much worse here in the United States. I'm ducking for cover every day. I mean, these people have no soul, no conscience. Nothing whatsoever.
Don't forget the people, Rick, that are pushed out of helicopters. I mean, how many people? This is absurdity, but I'd like to ask these chamber people, these geniuses, well, how many deaths resulted from people being pushed out of helicopters in D.C.? If you want to use that analogy, it's ridiculous.
Well, how many CEOs? If we were going to have a free trade agreement with a country that had 49 CEOs assassinated, do you think we'd have that free trade agreement? I don't think so. When it's just those lowly workers, well, then that, we can go after them. No big deal there. Amazing, amazing stuff. Here's another great story. Our governor has threatened to veto any taxes on the drilling industry. I understand our state's got some problems. We got a budget deficit, and you've got a governor who's saying we're gonna whack off $1 billion in education funding. We're gonna take 56% of the higher education budget, but I am gonna veto any tax on the drillers. They're done.
Don't worry about it.
Not going to tax fracking. We're not going to tax any of that. We're going to let them do their dangerous thing. We're going to let them pump all those toxic chemicals in the ground, and we're not going to tax them. We're not going to do anything to them. We want this industry to grow. And we find that where they said we were going to create, you know, 40, 50,000 jobs, less than 10,000 jobs have been created. And the majority of those, I would argue, aren't even by Pennsylvanians. And you look at this and you go, really? This guy? Is this what he's thinking? Is it as simple as we think it is, that he's just bought and paid for? Or is he this brain dead? Or does he hate kids that much? Or does he hate seniors that much? Because the House Republicans came and said, well, you know, we'll return some of the money to education, but we'll cut, you know, all the low-income people. So we'll pit, you know, the old disabled folks against the children. So that's a good battle, because nobody, you know, nobody could fight against children, could they? I mean, I'm amazed by this. I really am. And today there were, you know, there were some 50 people at the governor's mansion today saying, you know what, hey, do the right thing, man. We've got money. We've got a bunch of money that we didn't expect for this budget. Don't punish your citizens.
Well, it's worse than that, Rick. Well, at the same time, his party leaders, now, instead of a $27.3 billion, they want to take that budget down below 26, which means even more cuts.
26?
Yes.
No, I didn't see that. Where did you see that at?
I saw that in the Harrisburg. That's just their talk behind the scenes. Whether they can get it, I don't know. You're talking to conservatives now, right?
You must be talking mad cow. The only person I can think of is Metcalf, who would be dumb enough to do something like that. But
well, why would that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me that he would say it. It would surprise me if the Republican Party came out and that was their platform, because that would be the end of them,
well,
I think.
Anything they do now doesn't surprise me, because this is their optimum situation for them. This is their day. They believe the time is now. They want to go for everything they've wanted probably for the last 20 years. They're going after it. And this is their way. This is their way of reducing the size of government. This is their way of, quote, cutting taxes.
Yay. How very nice. Last thing before we take a quick break. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the things Republicans seem to hate the most, they came out with a new report this week showing that more than 5.5 million Americans with traditional Medicare one in six people with Medicare took advantage of one or more of the recommended preventative screening benefits now available for free thanks to the Affordable Care Act. The services, which include mammograms, bone density screenings, and screenings for prostate cancer, were offered at no additional charge. You know, you look at this and you go, Ben Franklin, ounce of prevention, pound of cure. We catch these diseases early, maybe we can avoid hundreds of thousands of dollars in outlays of cash. Maybe just a thought. But again, you know, short-sighted folks here who are running our government, cutting $1 billion from education. I mean, really, are we going to allow our education system to crumble like our infrastructure has been crumbling? Are we really going to do that to the future of this country? I mean, really, I wish someone would explain to me the rationale in this, that cutting $1 billion somehow is going to make the schools more competitive. It goes back to what I said in the first segment. You know, how is it that cutting government spending is going to create jobs? It's not. It's going to cost jobs. All those people who are working for defense contractors and all those people who are working, providing services to the community, doing the things that we need them to do, somehow that cutting all that spending is going to create jobs? I'm not getting it. It'd be nice if someone explained it to me. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Because, you know, you look at this, it's really a backward logic. I mean, it's really, you know, walking backwards. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk with Mike Ludwig. He wrote a great piece on pesticides and politics for truthout.org. We've got a link on our site at therickSmithShow.com. We're going to take a break. Right back after this with Mike Ludwig.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling against a million women workers at Walmart could add fuel to the union organizing fire at the giant retailer. Jesse Russell reports.
On Monday, the Supreme Court declined to hear a class action lawsuit that alleges the worldwide corporation Walmart had discriminated against women. Justice Anthony Scalia, writing for the majority, said the entire company couldn't be held accountable for what could be the actions of managers not representative of the entire company. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the partial counterposition that while the company shouldn't face damages, the court should have heard the case because there is evidence of systematic sex discrimination. The United Food and Commercial Workers has been seeking to organize Walmart stores in both the United States and Canada, so the union has been following this case closely. Assistant Director Jennifer Stapleton of Making Change at Walmart.
Women at Walmart know that discrimination is real. What we're finding now is that associates are more interested in taking action collectively since the legal system doesn't seem to be the way that's going to work for them.
Stapleton said her organization is now working with a new Walmart's employee group called Organization United for Respect at Walmart, which hopes to represent workers' interests collectively in order to provide education and improve working conditions.
Rather than waiting on the company or the government or anybody else to sanction their right to have a voice, associates just came together to form one through our Walmart.
If you're in solidarity with workers and you're traveling to Chicago, striking Hyatt workers ask that you don't stay at Hyatt hotels in the Windy City.
Support the boycott, not to come inside these hotels if they're not going to treat the workers what their chests do. Our workers are standing up for what's right.
United Here workers went on strike against the four Chicago area Hyatt hotels Monday. Will Spain is door captain at one of the Chicago Hyatts. Spain says the main issue is job security.
The Hyatt has added temp workers to work alongside our folks to try to take away their jobs. We need the support from the community. We need support from the religious leaders.
Before striking, the workers bargained with Hyatt for 20 months. United Here says Hyatt is owned by billionaires yet wants to outsource work and impose dangerous conditions on housekeepers. The American Journal of Industrial Medicine found in 2010 that Hyatt housekeepers had the highest injury rates of the five major hotel companies.
They do a 16-room quota a day, and they're beaten down. They can't go home and feed their families at the end of the day.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green.
Well, you know, that's what we got to do, pass something on down to the kids. And, you know, you stop and you look at, you know, here in Pennsylvania, we're talking about this fracking, talking about drilling for this natural gas, pumping these toxic chemicals in the ground to break up the ground and bring it back out and dispose of it. You know, what do you do with all these chemicals? How do you have, how do you have commerce and still have a planet left? What do you do? Where do you go? That's why I saw this story over at with our friends at truthout.org, a special investigation by Mike Ludwig, the pesticides and politics of America's eco-war. And I thought, you know, there's an interesting topic to talk about. How do we make that balance between, you know, growing food that we can eat or growing food that probably shouldn't? But I've got Mike Ludwig on the line. Again, the piece is a special investigation over at truthout.org, the pesticides and politics of America's eco-war. We've got links at therickssmithshow.com. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I got to start off right off by saying when I read through the article, as soon as I read the word Monsanto, I got to be honest, I pulled back and said I'm against whatever it is that they're doing, I'm against.
Right, yeah, you know, Monsanto is kind of infamous And they did play a big role in this story. And what they've also done, which is something that's revealed in this story, is they've kind of helped the federal government set the national policy toward invasive species. And that policy has been increasingly in the past decade more based on chemical eradication, like we saw here in Washington.
Well, let's walk through this a little bit. You talk about a little town in Washington State, oyster farmers, I guess you would call them, who've chosen, you know what, we're not gonna do any more taking of oysters because of the chemicals that are in the water. We're not feeding people this stuff.
Right, yeah, you know, what we're looking at here is a small business, a small oyster farm where the oysters were harvested by hand, and the big money operations in the area have used pesticides and herbicides for years to kill unwanted pests. But everything really changed in their area when they decided to eradicate an entire species of grass that was growing in the bay using helicopters full of herbicides, using boats spraying herbicides. And some of these herbicides drifted onto the small oyster farms, oyster beds, and their oysters tested positive for the chemicals, and they stopped selling, and they had to shut down their farm.
Yeah, the question then becomes, you know, where's the benefit? Where's the risk? Where do we stand in this? Is it this species of invasive grass worth poisoning ourselves over? And I guess that's a question for the community.
Absolutely. You know, some of the people I talked to there kind of put it to me as it's a cost-benefit analysis they had to do. You know, some of the oyster farmers were worried the grass was going to continue to take over parts of the bay and get in the way of their dredging efforts. And there's also a wildlife refuge there that attracts tourists, and they thought that the grass was kind of keeping birds from coming to the area that people wanted to see. So there was a concern that it could have, you know, an economic consequence for the local economy. But at the same time, you have to wonder, is spraying thousands of gallons of herbicide into the pristine waters in your neighborhood the best way to deal with that?
Yeah, because I got to be honest, there can't be any good jobs on a dead planet.
Absolutely.
You know, and I look at what they do around here where they spray for bugs and they, you know, you see the helicopters up there dropping, you know, these chemicals all over the place, and you go, that can't be good for us. Even though they said, we've studied it, and, you know, the studies are there and there's minimal risk and all that. I'm sorry, I don't know that I buy it.
Well, you know, you can look at the chemicals I talk about in this story, and that's glyphosate, also known as Roundup, which is made by Monsanto, and imazapyr. You know, Roundup is the stuff that's sprayed on genetically engineered crops across the world. And if you talk to some researchers, they'll say it's safe. We have the testing to prove it. And other people say no long-term testing has really been done on a lot of these chemicals. We really don't know what's going to happen when they're used in mass. What's going to happen down the road to the places that we rely on as natural areas and places where we're growing food?
You know, when I look at this, though, you know, the question then becomes, we're pushing 7 billion people. Somehow we've got to figure out how to feed all 7 billion people. And are these, I mean, this is really a balancing question. Do we use these pesticides? Because some say the bounties are, you know, we're able to get more because less is destroyed. Some say, well, what's the point if it's all poisoned? So I guess the question is, where do we fall on this?
You know, that's a tough one. It's actually an international debate that's happening right now. And you can look into the developing world where you have, you know, large foundations like the Gates Foundation pouring lots of money into introducing industrialized agriculture to developing countries. You can also look here with the debate between, you know, monocrop, industrial agriculture, and the organics movement. And it really comes down to science that is independent. You know, when I look at issues like this, a lot of the regulatory information and a lot of the information that's available through the government actually comes directly from the companies that make these chemicals. And independent research is really the place that we can turn to see a kind of objective eye as far as the effects on the environment of using these kind of chemicals.
I go more and more what you just said scares the hell out of me. The fact that the people who are supposed to be overseeing this stuff are basically just copy and pasting what the corporation hands them.
Right, you know, you can look at invasive species, which is something that herbicides and pesticides are sprayed on all the time, different kind of plants and animals deemed invasive by the government. But if you look at who's created this policy for the government, it's BASF, which is a large chemical company. It's Monsanto. In fact, on the Invasive Species Advisory Council, which advised the Bush administration on invasive species, Nelroy Jackson, one of Monsanto's top herbicide developers, was one of the main advisors on that council. And this was from, I believe, 2002 to 2008.
Let me ask you this, Mike. You know, the people who were there, you know, who live in that area, have there been any abnormal health effects by spraying these chemicals? I mean, because it is a small area, I would assume most of the people who live there are have been there for generations. Have there been any testing, anything that pops up with them?
Well, you know, it's hard to draw conclusive, you know, lines between people's personal health problems and what's happened. But I can tell you about the people that I met there. The two kind of activists who owned this small farm, and they were fighting these herbicide sprays. One, Fritzi Cohen, her husband had died of cancer about 10 years earlier after fighting pesticide sprays for over a decade. And her business partner, Keith Starvum, the actual oyster man who worked the farm, was suffering from lymphoma. And if you ask them, they'll tell you they believe the chemicals made them sick. You know, I'm no doctor. I can't make that decision, but that's what they will say. And they have friends, too, that came over, and they were actually all talking about, we were having dinner together when I was in Washington, and they were all talking about what was happening at the chemotherapy clinic and who was in there and who was out. And one of them turned to me and said, I'm sorry I can't invite you in this conversation, but you just haven't had any interesting diseases yet. And that kind of really scared me as an outsider.
You know, one of the things you write in your piece is, you know, right now is a time when in this age, we've got environmentalists, you know, teaming up kind of with big business, which, again, kind of scares me, this whole how lines are being muddied, if you will, where you don't really have a clear. And as I read your story, there's no real clear answer. Do you allow these invasive grasses, this invasive species, to come in and dominate, or do you poison the water? There's really nothing clear cut there for people to side with.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, these are tough decisions that land managers have to make. And for environmentalists, it often comes down to a divide in philosophy. Some environmentalists will say, you know, we need to let nature take its course. And other environmentalists will say that nature is ours to dominate, to control, and shape to our liking. And depending on which side of that debate you lie philosophically could depend on your perspective and how you deal with something like invasive species.
You know, because what I keep hearing here, and, you know, I'm not thrilled with the idea of poking holes in the ground and pumping toxic chemicals in the ground to break up the ground to push out this gas. Not all that thrilled about, you know, poisoning our water and our air and our land. But, you know, there are some who believe, you know, it's worth the risk to have the jobs. And, again, I guess in this situation that you're talking about here, it does come down to environment versus jobs.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. You know, invasive species, when we talk about this specifically, we can talk about this grass, Spartina, specifically in my story. More jobs could have been created if that grass was removed manually. More people could have been employed picking it out of the ground with their hands or using tools or using you know, dredging machines than two guys flying a helicopter spraying a bunch of chemicals.
Yeah,
you know,
I think
employment opportunities are what we make them.
Yeah, I think as you wrote in the article, Chemical Kim said it came down to money, though.
Absolutely. I mean, when that's what happens in so many of these environmental issues, and if you really find the truth, you just have to follow the money.
And I guess that's just about anything you're ever going to deal with. It comes down to the bottom line will always be dollars and cents.
I think so. I think in the kind of economy that we live in today, that is the bottom line.
In going forward on this issue, are they still doing this herbicide? I know at one point you had said that the Spartina grass that's there has gone from something like, I think it was like 20-some thousand acres down to 5 or something. Is that right?
Yeah, it went from about nearly 10,000 to about 20 acres.
8,500 down to 20.
Yeah.
And are they still dumping this stuff on those final 20 to kind of eradicate it completely?
Well, that's what they say they're doing, but, you know, I was up there, and I know that Washington, like a lot of states, is having a huge budget crisis. They're running out of funding for this program. They say there's only 20 acres left, but I went out and just walked down the beach, and within 10 minutes found patches of this grass that was supposed to be eradicated. And it kind of raises a question, you know, even if we do spend millions of dollars, and in this case millions of federal dollars, can we actually control nature?
And at the end of the day, that's the big question. Do we have that kind of power? And you look at the tornadoes and the tsunamis and the hurricanes and all of this stuff going on, can we really control it? I don't think so. But the piece, a great, well-written piece, a special investigation over at truthout.org, The Pesticides and Politics of America's Eco-War, great piece written by Mike Ludwig. We've got a link at our site at therixsmithshow.com. I suggest taking a look at it. Mike, I appreciate the time, and a real great piece.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
To the Rick Smith Show.
David Koch, the right-wing multi-billionaire, likes to pose as a class act. He's thrown around several million bucks, for example, to get a wing of Manhattan's Lincoln Center named for him and to buy a seat on the board of WGBH, Boston's prestigious public television station. These purchases make nice wallpaper for him, but they can't cover up the ugliness at the core of Koch's heart. He's poured a fortune and his very soul into the creation of dozens of political attack groups and corporate fronts to advance his self-serving plutocratic vision of America. Far from a class act, the Koch operation is as crass as they come. One of the crudest arms of his vast and secretive political network is called Americans for Prosperity. It runs all sorts of astroturf campaigns to knock down the prosperity of working families and lift up the power and prosperity of corporate elites, like the Kochs. AFP's Michigan branch recently showed what it's made of in a campaign to kill funding for a new international bridge between Detroit and Canada. Building this bridge would create jobs and ease traffic snarls, but it would compete with a corporate-owned toll bridge, and the Kochs virulently oppose all things public. To stir up public opposition, AFP went into a hard-hit Detroit neighborhood and plastered people's homes with official-looking flyers that declared in bold type, "Eviction Notice." The bogus flyers told homeowners that the State Transportation Agency was prepared to seize their homes to make way for the new bridge. "It was meant to startle people," said AFP's clueless and classless state director, who was perversely proud of the panic his lie had caused in this distressed community. This is Jim Hightower saying, such sensitivity is what has made the Koch name a cuss word all across America.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Well, it'll only be a couple hours. What, another hour and 42 minutes? And we won't have the big wiener to beat around. No siree, the big wiener at midnight tonight, going to be no longer a member of the House of Representatives. So we'll not have the wiener to beat anymore. He just handed in his resignation to House Speaker John Boehner and Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. His office is still open, and this is kind of answering some of the questions. The House Clerk's office will assume the responsibilities of running his office until they can have a special election to get somebody in, and his office is open. So that's a good thing. At least the constituents will have the ability to call in and complain, like any good constituent would do. Don't you think, Jake? I know you call your guy an awful lot.
Sometimes I do.
Sometimes.
I'm going to miss him. I loved his passion, and I just wish more Democrats would have that passion. Fortunately, he was his own undoing, and we can argue.
Stupid, you know, stupid, stupid.
Yes, and we can argue that Democrats shouldn't have basically
to the cave.
Offered
surrender.
Him as a sacrificial lamb. But that's in fact what he was. He was a sacrificial lamb. He took the hit for the good of the party in the eyes of the leaders, for better or for worse, and he's gone. Fortunately, I believe a Democrat will be elected in his district. It's a pretty solid Democratic district.
Yeah, but again, I don't know that you're going to have. You know, maybe somebody will surprise me, and well, maybe the next guy will be better. Who knows?
Maybe someday we'll see him run for governor or something else. He wouldn't be the first to have his political career resurrected. There are guys that did a lot worse, and they're still around. So I'm sure we'll see him down the road.
Well, again, I got to be honest. It's really a dumb thing. And the whole thing was just plain dumb. But what I loved was the Republicans out there saying, well, he should resign, because when we do something dumb like that, we resign. Which brings me to my next story. The people at the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, they're saying that Senator David Diaper Dave Vitter, may have gone a bit too far when he demanded President Obama's Interior Secretary approve deep water oil well drillings in exchange for a salary increase. Kind of saying, hey, you know, maybe it went just a bit too far. So CREW filed this complaint. They want the Senate Select Committee on Ethics to investigate Vitter for bribery. Ken Salazar, in a letter, May 23rd, to Secretary Ken Salazar, Vitter was very clear that he would not vote for a pay raise until the Department of Interior began issuing these 6 deep water exploratory permits each month. And, you know, here's the thing. There's part of me that looks at that and goes, you know, come on. The guy was just, I think he was just being stupid. I don't know that he was really writing that he was going to bribe the guy. But... you know, I think there are much bigger things to go after Diaper Dave Vitter over. You know, maybe the fact that his name was in the D.C. Madam's book, and he did admit to doing some things that, well, he's not proud of.
But Rick, you know, with our Democratic buddy that just got lounged, got axed, the Republicans are saying, but he used his office. He used his office. It was inside the walls of the Capitol. He used his
office. He spends 24 hours a day.
And your point is, I mean, do you expect him to go knock on doors of these women that he, you know, he had?
Maybe had he wouldn't have had any pictures. You know, it goes back to what my grandfather always said. If you're messing up, make sure you're the only one who knows you're messing up. Because at least you got a half a shot of not getting ratted out. Because once you tell somebody else, it's sure that you're going to get ratted out. But if you keep it to yourself, 50-50, you're not going to rat on yourself.
Well, it was comedy art trying to hear some of these Republican apologists try to differentiate between Wiener and what several of the Republicans did. I mean, it was pure comedy hour.
I got to be honest, I love Diaper Dave. The thought of that just kind of makes me go, wow. You know, I'm generally pretty, you know, pretty... open, pretty, yeah, do whatever,
gotta be
whatever
a,
you got to do.
That's,
you know,
pretty kinky, you know.
That's just wrong. That's plain wrong. You know what
compared
else?
Compared to what? Compared to what? Well, seeing a madam just, you know, for regular sex or what? Compared to what is that wrong?
I would have no problem with that. You know, we're leaving this. We're leaving this behind because we're going to go down a road we're not going to come back from.
Yeah, we're going to step
let's
in.
Move it on. Christine O'Donnell has emailed her supporters. She's touting her book that's coming out here, I guess, August 16th. The new book is going to be out from St. Martin's Press, titled Troublemaker, Let's Do What It Takes to Make America Great Again. And, you know, she's the tea twizzler from Delaware, you know, who's not a witch, evidently not a witch. What I loved, I got to be honest, I just absolutely love St. Martin Press's description of the book. You got to love this. Troublemaker is about where O'Donnell came from, the Philadelphia suburbs with 5 kids in a room, and what she weathered in the 2010 election. But the core of the book is a clear, straightforward discussion of an America that yearns to embrace freedom, opportunity through personal responsibility, and how it is hamstrung and stymied by excessive regulations, taxation, and the sanctimony of the nanny state. And Troublemaker will deliver an important, rousing message about what we do with the quiet anger in America today. where we can go and how strong we can be from here. Learning readers that challenging the status quo makes the political establishment push back. O'Donnell wants to build a movement that will continue to goad it and also to fill her campaign coffers and to fill her bank account because she's never really had a job. And I think that's the point we have to focus on. She never really had a job.
And speaking of a job, has there any been any conclusive end to that investigation, or is it still ongoing?
All done.
And she didn't violate any laws?
They dropped it all.
Okay.
It is what it is. You know.
She avoided that one, didn't she?
Well, you know, sweep, sweep. But again, you know, what amazes me is that somebody gave her a book deal. And what will amaze me even more is if anybody actually buys it, because there's part of me that really does not think the think tank establishment is going to buy into this. I think they would just prefer her to go away. But I don't. It's going to be interesting. I can't wait for August 16th to see, because you can generally track where these books go. The New York Times does a nice job of telling you if she makes the bestseller list, if they were institutional buys or if they were individual buys. So it'll be interesting to see if the big think tanks, if the radical right-wing money machine buys into it. So I'm kind of curious. If it comes out in the library, if my local library gets it, I may flip through it. Somebody puts it online, I may, you know, kind of flip through it because I would love to see, you know, how she's going to push back against the nanny state and how the nation's hamstrung and stymied by excessive regulation, taxation, and the sanctimony of the nanny state, which is really, I mean, really just copied and pasted from every right-wing presidential campaign.
Did she really write that?
You know, and that's the question I got to find out. I seriously doubt that she wrote the book. I mean, rarely do you find these people who write their own book. They usually sit down with someone who knows English and grammar and tells them, this is what I'd like my book to be, and then they write it out.
What you just read. To be honest, just those couple months she was in the limelight and listening to her.
She couldn't have written
quite
that.
Frankly, that's above her pay grade.
Well, that's just me.
Well, I could be wrong, and I will apologize if I find it. I will make a public apology here.
I just told you.
Here on the Rick Smith Show.
St. Martin's Press described the book. They actually put out the release, so there you go. In other news, 22,000 would-be immigrants have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. State Department, alleging that it was unfairly denied legal immigrant rights. And because you remember they had this bizarre lottery not too long ago where they set up this system, and because of a computer glitch, the majority of the people who were allowed to become citizens were in the first 20% of applicants. Because of this computer glitch, you know, the bingo balls must not have been in that day. So they used a computer program instead of, you know, the old-fashioned bingo balls. Since evidently that's how we're deciding who gets into the country nowadays. Which, you know, I look at this story and I go, two things pop out of me. One, you've got people from outside the country suing us, and there are actually lawyers taking the case, which kind of makes me wonder what the hell's wrong with us. That people who don't even live here yet, and this is where the immigration people, I'm going to agree with, what are 22,000 people who aren't citizens doing suing the country? But that's a whole other argument. And the other part of this is really, really highlighting the fact that please, at some point, somebody sit down and figure out a rational immigration policy. Somebody, please. We can't have 50 states with 50 different immigration policies. We can't have 50 different states doing 50 different things. I know that's what the radical right would love to see. I just, not seeing it and hoping not to be the case. But, again, another one of these bizarre stories. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about this Walmart Watch case, and we've asked Carrie Axelrod from Walmart Watch to come talk to us about the Supreme Court case yesterday, the decision. So that'll be interesting. Be back right after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Smith Show.
Show, changing America for the better.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make things happen!
With a PSECU Home Equity Line of Credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseccu.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions. 'Cause the union's missing.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. It's been a good and a bad week for Walmart, if you look at it. Yesterday, the Supreme Court decided in their favor, threw out the lawsuit, the class action lawsuit, basically rewriting class action law in this country, again, taking the rights of people to sue in mass. But here in Pennsylvania, Walmart lost their appeal. $187.6 million verdict for the workers who had been basically screwed out of wages, forced to work in their breaks and off the clock. Just amazing stuff. And, you know, it's this kind of stuff that we've got to stop. And it's a good thing that there are people out there who are paying attention and working on this. Folks like Carrie Axelrod, who works over at Walmart Watch. It's good to see that kind of stuff going on. We've got Carrie on the line right now. Carrie, thanks for taking time for us.
Yep, thank you for having me on, Rick.
You know, I look at the Supreme Court decision yesterday, and the sad thing is, you know, they didn't argue that they didn't do all of the things that they were accused of. They only argued that, oh, sorry, you can't sue us like this. You've got to sue us one at a time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you hit the nail on the head. there. What the Supreme Court ruled yesterday essentially just made it harder for, you know, workers at Walmart to have a fair trial, to have their day in court, and to have a fair chance at receiving justice. You know, essentially they didn't say that the, you know, women at Walmart that are bringing these claims against the companies, that they weren't discriminated against. What they did was just make it harder, and that they couldn't join together as one lawsuit.
And basically saying that the vast majority of them are never going to get their day in court, because no lawyer is going to go taking on a company as big as Walmart with the resources they've got for the claims that, for the money that they would receive over it.
Which, yeah, I mean, you know, I think that as you read in the news, there are certainly a number of attorneys that have given their opinions in terms of that, exactly what you said, that it's going to make it harder for those individual cases to then move forward. Sure. But I think that the sort of main issue here is that, you know, the legal avenue is just one way that workers can, you know, receive justice. That there is actually another way that workers can, you know, join together and collectively fight for, you know, a more just workplace at Walmart. That workers, you know, can join together as one voice and, you know, demand equal pay and fair treatment. And, you know, one way to do that is certainly through, you know, collectively joining in a union. And that's something that, you know, obviously at Walmart Watch we strongly believe in.
Well, I mean, if you look at both scenarios, the one with the Supreme Court decision just the other day, basically discriminating against women, and the one I want to talk about here in Pennsylvania, where Walmart lost the appeal, $187 million verdict to people who basically got screwed. You know, they got cheated out of wages by working through their lunch and working off the clock. I look at both situations, and if you had a collective bargaining agreement, neither would be happening. Because at the moment it happened, you would have immediate recourse.
Yeah, and I think that these, you know, both of these cases are pretty eye-opening, and they're, you know, these are workers, you know, and vast numbers. You know, I think that what was it, 187,000 workers in Pennsylvania, and then, you know, 1.6 million, women and, current and former associates in the Supreme Court case that are saying, hey, you know, that we're not working in a fair work environment, and, you know, that our working environment at Walmart just isn't right, and something needs to change.
Right. You know, let's talk about this verdict, because part of me looks at it and goes, okay, they won, you know, it was upheld here in the state of Pennsylvania. The Superior Court sided with the workers. What's to stop it from moving its way on up into the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court saying, well, you know what, maybe not so much. We're going to decide almost the same thing we decided with the case yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a legal scholar by any means, so I don't want to, you know, sort of comment on, you know, the legal challenges that may lead ahead. But I think that, you know, that your point is taken is this, that there are certainly, you know, pros and cons and legal challenges, and that can't be the only way that workers are able to, you know, demand equal pay at Walmart, you know, and stop the discrimination and stop the favoritism that is taking place in the workplace. But that's certainly one avenue that workers should pursue, but there are other avenues available.
Yeah, absolutely. And you look at this $187 million verdict. That's just Pennsylvania. How many other states across this country are you seeing the same kind of, because as I understand it, and maybe you'll be able to help me here, but as I understand it, this kind of cheating, you know, punching people out, you know, at the end of the day and letting them work an extra bunch of time, or punching them back in, as they're working through lunch, basically stealing wages from them, is systematic. It's nationwide. It's the corporate culture.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that what you've seen in the Pennsylvania case is that that's something, you know, that was certainly widespread in Pennsylvania, and that's what the case was able to look at.
Are you seeing anything that across the nation then? I mean, are there other suits like this in other states, or don't you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about where the status of other suits across the country, but, you know, something that we're seeing at Walmart Watch is that associates are coming to us, you know, regularly and sharing their stories about, you know, their experience at Walmart. And, you know, I just heard from someone the other day, for example, that was talking about how they got a promotion at Walmart, and then, you know, a previous raise that they had received was taken away from them and then given back to them. So essentially they got no pay promotion or no pay raise for their promotion. And so there are certainly individual stories of associates that we're hearing from across the country that are sort of speaking to the concerns that you certainly heard in the Pennsylvania case.
You know, I think back to my grandmother. My grandmother worked in a small department store, you know, a small version of Walmart back in the 80s, retired in 1985, making almost as much as the Walmart workers are making now, only she had full health care benefits, full vision, full dental, 6 weeks vacation, paid holidays, overtime, all of these things, and a union on the job. This is back in 1985. 26 mm-hmm. years ago, and the workers in the same type of job, not making much more, and had most certainly with less benefits. And you go to that and you go, well, how did we get to this point? How did we allow that industry to fall so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think that your point about the extremely low wages that workers at Walmart make is well taken. You know, we do know based on information that's available that an average associate at Walmart makes $8.81 an hour. You know, that's poverty level wages, and that most of them sort of have to supplement their income, you know, and are only able to get benefits through public services, such as Medicaid. And that's certainly, you know, not an hourly wage where an associate can provide for their family. You know, that, you know, especially, you know, so many women that we're hearing, from that, you know, are taking jobs at Walmart because that's what's available and, you know, and only want to do right for their family, but just aren't able to provide for them.
Yeah, it's a sad, sad situation. And what bothers me is we still have people who, you know, they flock to Walmart because they claim they got low prices. And most people I talk to say, well, the prices aren't all that low. Don't kid yourself. Anyway, Carrie Axelrod, I appreciate the time and the work you guys do over there at Walmart Watch. Lots of great information. Keep up the fight. Thank you so much. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
Great. Anytime. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much. You know, I look at this, Jake, and you look at this $187.6 million verdict, and you go, you know what that was? You know, that wasn't some pie in the sky, pulled a verdict out of her behind. Those were stolen wages. Those were wages that could have gone into those workers' pockets, that could have gone back into the local economy and supported the local economy and could have helped.
And that's what they could prove, I'm sure.
What they could prove.
In actuality, it was probably considerably more.
And that's an excellent point. That's what they could prove. Amazing stuff. And I'm sure they're not the only one. Look, I'm not letting all the other ones off the hook. They're just the one that got caught. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Rick Smith.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on.
Children don't only depend on me doing my job. They're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse, because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Hey, you want to talk about greed? Let's talk about the finance people, the campaign finance people that work for Newt Gingrich that quit today. I guess they were looking at the fundraising numbers. Their fundraising director, Jody Thomas, and fundraising consultant, Mary Hittman, they both quit today. Evidently, the campaign is about $1 million in debt already. 2 weeks ago, you'll remember, in less than two weeks, Newt has had 16 other staffers quit as well. So the Gingrich train coming to a screeching halt, actually derailing as we speak. What's interesting is recent reports have shown that the campaign didn't have enough cash on hand for the $25,000 Ames straw poll filing fee, and they didn't have the $30,000 for a list of previous Iowa caucus attendees, which, you know, you get into these races, costs a lot of money. You gotta ante up a little bit. They didn't have the money. So how is O'Nudy going to run a campaign when he is already a mill in the hock? Amazing stuff. I got to tell you, it's amazing stuff.
Maybe they figured out what we had thought all along, that Newt probably really wasn't all that serious. He just wanted to ratchet up
his book sales.
His book sales and his high profile, or what's left of it, out there in the public. And it's all about money at the end of the day. And by all accounts, some of these people, if the governor of Texas gets into it, some of these people will, in fact, go work for him. So we shall see.
John Huntsman has thrown his hat into the ring. The former governor and also the former ambassador to China has decided, yep, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it in a way that, is going to be on the up and up. He says, we're not choosing new leaders. We're choosing whether we're becoming yesterday's story or tomorrow's. Everything's at stake, he says. And this is the hour when we choose our future. You're not going to be it, John. Sorry. You say what you want. It ain't happening. Because I got to be honest, he is just another in a line of cookie-cutter Republicans. While he was governor of Utah, drastically increased the state's budget deficit. Really put them in the hole. He also is one of these flat tax guys, instituted in Utah. And you know what happened? Big deficits. He's also another one of these guys who, oh, we need to do away with the corporate income tax. We need to eliminate him. In fact, he tried to eliminate him completely in Utah. And if you think, Granny, you think you're okay, he wants to end Medicare. Get rid of it. Also, he believes in climate change, which I think is going to be very difficult for him to sell to the radical retards on the right. I shouldn't say that. The radical right-wing nutcases. He believes in it, but he doesn't want to do anything about it, which is kind of one of those things that makes you go, what are you doing? Also, he wants a balanced budget amendment. So understand this. I've figured this out because I'm trying to figure it out myself. And this is the right wing's answer. We want this magical balanced budget amendment because we need to live within our means. But we're going to give away all of our revenue. So basically, we're going to quit our jobs and still expect to live in the same house, drive the same car, eat the same food, and have the same lights and all that other stuff, all the bills that we had. But we're just going to quit our job. That's the Republican way of thinking. And it's going to work. I guess it's good to be optimistic.
Well, I think you have to give him just a teensy, teensy bit of credit. He did try to separate himself by saying he thinks that the president really is an American and wasn't that big of him. He said the president should be judged on whether he is the best man for the job, not whether he's an American. So that was kind of big of him. That will kind of raise the hackles of some of the right-wingers. But if that's all he got, that's not near enough.
Well, here's my problem. One of my big problems with him is he's fluent in Mandarin, which is great. Maybe oranges. Maybe is that what you're thinking? Oranges or Chinese?
Well, our readers might not know what that is. That's a Chinese dialect.
All right, there you go. Thanks for clarifying. But again, yeah, one of these things. He's one of these guys who's well liked by the Chinese. I got a problem with that. I don't want my president to be well liked by the Chinese, considering he was ambassador there for a while. And you look at all of the wonderful treatment that the Chinese have gotten, and I'm a little leery. If I were gonna vote for a Republican, it would be one of those guys who says, you know what, we're gonna hold the Chinese accountable. Because at the end of this, I don't blame the Chinese for stealing our lunch. I don't blame them for stealing our manufacturing. I don't blame them for kicking the tar out of us. I blame us. I blame our government for putting us in a position that we're the ones who are taking the beating. In the past, we've always put this country first. We've always put our national security, our income, our standard of living first. Now what we're doing, we're basically saying to corporate America, we're going to give you whatever you want and wish and hope that you'll do something to help this country. And in reality, what they're doing is they're just leaving in mass. They're saying, thank you for the travel money. We will be happy to go elsewhere with your money. And then we'll bring all those things back in here freely and sell them as if they're American products. And, you know, last week I had said something that caught, our producer Brett off by, off kilter there. And I said, and he corrected me. I said inter instead of intra. Most of the trade that goes on between China and the U.S. is intra-corporate, which means that corporations that are U.S. corporations set up plants in China, and they trade among themselves. It's not even China and the U.S. It's GE and GE. It's Whirlpool and Whirlpool, or GM and GM. It's not even countries anymore. It's global corporations. And, in talking last night about the dot-com thing, these top-level domain names where now, GE can be .GE. Or, you can be dot Boeing or dot what Bank of America or dot whoever. No longer countries. Corporations. And maybe that's the end of the road. Maybe that's where we're going. Maybe that's where we're going to have to go. And when we get to that point, we won't have to worry about thinking. We won't have to worry about history. We won't have to worry about anything. It will be nice and sanitary. They will fix all of the little problems throughout history. The Civil War will have never happened. We have never had slavery. It'll be a wonderful history to learn. We've always been benevolent and wonderful and terrific, don't you think? I think that's the way it'll probably go. Look at all of those old sci-fi movies. Anyway, our boy Tricky Ricky Santorum was on the trail there in Ames, Iowa. He was at the Story County GOP Central Committee there in Ames, and he had a great quote. He says, we don't even know our own history. He said, there was a report that just came out last week that the worst subject of children in America's schools is not math and science, it's history. That's right. The worst subject. How can we be a free people, he said? How can we be a people that fight for America if we don't know who America is or what we're all about? He said, this is my opinion. A conscious effort on the part of the left, on the part of those evil people on the left, who has a huge influence on our curriculum, to desensitize America to what American values are, so they are more pliable to the new values that they would impose on America. And I'm going, wait a second. What are you talking about? What conspiratorial little crackpot vehicle did you just get kicked out of? But again, you know, you can't lose a good frame. And, you know, you got Sarah Palin out there going, yeah, Paul Revere riding down the street, giddy up and like crazy, ringing those bells, firing those warning shots. Woohoo! Pow, pow, pow. Yeah, baby! Screaming at the top of his lungs. Didn't happen that way. The guy was trying to be quiet. He was going off to warn Hancock and Adams, as I remember it. He wasn't warning all the people in the streets. He was making sure that the lights were and the candles were on.
One if by land, two if by sea.
And you go, warning shots, really? But, you know, the right defended her. And they even tried to go and pull a Winston Smith and rewrite history on Wikipedia. I mean, that's where we're heading with this whole corporatization of the globe. Eventually, 1984 is going to happen. Eventually, there will be a Winston Smith who sits at his computer every day and, okay, well, let's rewrite yesterday. Yesterday was a great day. It was wonderful. We won the war.
So I imagine the Industrial Revolution never took place. The wars that labor had with management never took place.
Everything was wonderful.
The evolution of the labor movement never took place.
Kumbaya. You know, that's what I keep saying. You know, don't worry. Be happy when you hear the radical right screaming and you hear the radical extreme left screaming. When you hear their voices, everything's okay. When you have division, when you have partisanship, when you have factions, everything's okay. As long as you're hearing that. The second you stop hearing any point of view, the second you stop hearing about something, start worrying about it. Because it's not that it stopped happening. It's that you've stopped hearing about it. And, you know, again, you know, on talk radio, you don't hear very many voices from the left or from the center. Everything is extreme right wing because that's what the corporatists want you to hear. That's what the big corporations want to push. They don't want you to know that you're getting screwed. They don't want you to know that your grandparents had it much better. They don't want you to know that there used to be a pension system that you didn't have to contribute money out of your pocket into and hope that Wall Street wasn't going to steal it. They don't want you to know that. What they want you to know is that you've been given all of these wonderful things by a benevolent corporation who loves you. And they care about you. And they keep telling you that. In the nicest of terms. We care. Don't forget September of 2008. Don't forget. When the profit stopped and the fear started, what'd they do to you? What'd they do to the working people of this country? In mass, they kicked you to the curb. You saw their true colors. And I'm amazed every day when I hear someone say, well, the unions are just saying that their employers don't care about their employees. They don't, man. You know that. They care about the bottom line. They care about profit. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, talk about Tracy Morgan in the news right back after this. 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Yeah. saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News, I'm Doug Cunningham.
A U.S. Supreme Court ruling against a million women workers at Walmart could add fuel to the union organizing fire at the giant retailer. Jesse Russell reports.
On Monday, the Supreme Court declined to hear a class action lawsuit that alleges the worldwide corporation Walmart had discriminated against women. Justice Antonin Scalia, writing for the majority, said the entire company couldn't be held accountable for what could be the actions of managers not representative of the entire company. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the partial counterposition that while the company shouldn't face damages, the court should have heard the case, because there is evidence of systematic sex discrimination. The United Food and Commercial Workers has been seeking to organize Walmart stores in both the United States and Canada, so the union has been following this case closely. Assistant Director Jennifer Stapleton of Making Change at Walmart.
Women at Walmart know that discrimination is real. What we're finding now is that associates are more interested in taking action collectively since the legal system doesn't seem to be the way that's going to work for them.
Stapleton said her organization is now working with a new Walmart's employee group called Organization United for Respect at Walmart, which hopes to represent workers' interests collectively in order to provide education and improve working conditions.
Rather than waiting on the company or the government or anybody else to sanction their right to have a voice, associates just came together to form one through our Walmart.
If you're in solidarity with workers and you're traveling to Chicago, striking Hyatt workers ask that you don't stay at Hyatt hotels in the Windy City.
Support the boycott, not to come inside these hotels if they're not going to treat the workers what their chests do. Our workers are standing up for what's right.
Unite Here workers went on strike against the four Chicago area Hyatt hotels Monday. Will Spain is door captain at one of the Chicago Hyatts. Spain says the main issue is job security.
The Hyatt has added temp workers to work alongside our folks to try to take away their jobs. We need the support from the community. We need support from the religious leaders.
Before striking, the workers bargained with Hyatt for 20 months. Unite Here says Hyatt is owned by billionaires, yet wants to outsource work and impose dangerous conditions on housekeepers. The American Journal of Industrial Medicine found in 2010 that Hyatt housekeepers had the highest injury rates of the five major hotel companies.
They do a 16-room quota a day, and they're beaten down. They can't go home and feed their families at the end of the day.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Let me be clear. I am not gay. I never have been gay.
Being busted inside a jar, it's not a thing that a right-wing Republican should do. All your talk of family values, flushed away in scandalous loo news, and all your denials are stinking like piles of political poo.
Wonder what? Damn.
Tap three times with your loafer if you want me. Twice on the tank if the answer is no.
No?
A dirty Larry. Tap. He's unbuckling his beltway. White and far right means you're from Idaho.
Yes, Lusty Larry. Lusty Larry. I wonder what Lusty Larry Craig's up to these days. But again, you go back to the wiener thing, which I'm sure Larry would like to do. They didn't force Lusty Larry out. Lusty Larry got to finish his term. He got to knock on stalls all day long up until he said he wasn't going to run again. They didn't force him out. He didn't resign. He just didn't run for re-election, which he would not have been elected. And, that's the other part of the story. So it's interesting. And with all of this talk about gay marriage and about, the number of states trying to outlaw it, a couple of states considering it, the Borowitz Report came out with their spin today. The story goes, as lawmakers in New York clashed over legalizing gay marriage. A new study revealed that well over 70% of existing marriages may already be gay. The study conducted by Dr. Davis Logsdon of the Marital Behavior Institute at the University of Minnesota confirmed what many social scientists have long suspected. Within the first 5 years of marriages, most men, for all intent and purposes, become gay. Dr. Logsdon says, soon after marrying, most men stop hitting on women and start shopping for furniture. Scientifically speaking, how gay is that? Within 10 years, Dr. Logsdon says, a significant number of married men stop having sex with women altogether. There's only one way to describe someone who does not have sex with women, does not hit on women, and spends his free time shopping for furniture. And that word, to be scientific about it, is gay. Elsewhere, by a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court asked Kagan, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor to make them coffee. So there you go. This weekend, I got to be honest, Jake, you know, and you're listening, you know, going through the Borowitz report, I learned something about myself this past weekend when I took the kids to the pool. It was my son's baseball picnic where they, you know, they handed out their awards and did all of that stuff. And, you know, I learned some things of how I've changed. You know, I remember as a young man going to the pool, and I would spend most of my time talking to good-looking, young, cute lifeguards, you know, trying to get their phone number. And as an older man, I spent the entire time there Saturday talking to good-looking, young, cute lifeguards, trying to get their phone numbers. The difference was that as a young man, I was trying to get into their pants, and now I'm trying to get their phone numbers to line up babysitters. How life has changed. Life has certainly changed. But interestingly enough, you know, you remember the Tracy Morgan thing? Where he went off on this whole anti-gay rant and, you know, I'd stab my son if he came home gay and all this. Well, he had to make his amends. He held a press conference with the gay and lesbian group GLAAD. And, you know, he offered another in a long line of sincere apologies for what was really a homophobic rant at a performance in Nashville, Tennessee. He said, you know, I don't really see people as gay or straight. I just see them as human beings now, which I'm thinking a whole team of public relations people came up with. And he pointed out that, you know, to err is human, but to forgive is divine. And he said, all of these young people here have forgiven me. What I found interesting about the whole thing is they had this guy with him who evidently was the guy who, with his cell phone, recorded the rant. And I guess he's gay. I don't know. I think he is. I think that's how the story goes. And he said, you know, and I love this. He goes, I always thought that Tracy was a friend to the LBG community. I'm going, really? Have you not seen Tracy Morgan's stand-up? Really? And I guess, you know, there's part of me that goes, maybe there are some very stupid people in the world who are going to go to a comedy show by someone like Tracy Morgan and not expect what he got. I mean, it would be like me going when I went to see George Carlin, looking for someone who's going to talk well of government and corporations. Yeah, not going to happen. You got to know who you're going to see. Just amazing stuff. You know, but going back to the Borowitz report, you know, I find it's kind of funny, though. Like he says, you know, in 10 years, you know, married couples pretty much stop. And that's been my solution for the whole gay marriage thing. You know, because there are some people who are just repulsed by the whole idea of, you know, two men or two women or whatever. If you're that repulsed by it, let them get married. They'll stop eventually. Trust me. That's how it works. That's how the whole system works. Oh, amazing stuff. Anyway, Michelle Bachmann has announced her her presidential run last Monday with the other dwarfs on the stage there. Now she's going to launch officially her bid. And how many times can you launch a presidential campaign? Is that like having a grand opening, you know, every week? Welcome to the grand opening. This is the grand opening, the re-grand opening. Is this the new official launch? She says on Monday she's going to relaunch the campaign in Iowa. Amazing. I'm just shocked at how little we scrutinize these folks. It's all about nonsense.
Well, I mean, it's obvious she hasn't been. Now think about it. She hasn't been in the limelight for a couple of weeks since her intrusion into that fundraiser that was near our area concerning the vets and Memorial Day. Remember that? She inserted herself in that, which I thought was really tacky. Really, if I was those veterans, I would have totally ignored her. I thought that was so disrespectful.
Michelle Bachmann?
No. Sarah Palin.
Oh, well, welcome to the conversation. It was Bachmann I was talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about...
Well, no, Palin, I agree. That was just completely nuts.
Sarah Palin, excuse me. Oh, Michelle's
going
to run.
You're going, wait a second.
I thought you said Sarah, but because Michelle Bachmann already announced, basically.
I know.
Well,
that's
she did during the debate.
Welcome to the conversation, Jake. Thanks for taking time. Thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, okay. I take that back.
Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry. I just, you absolutely cracked me up on that one. I mean, that is like an absolute train wreck. I've just now completely stopped dead in my tracks.
Okay.
Oh, man. But anyway, Michelle Bachmann is going to, on Monday, going to reannounce, relaunch, whatever, the new grand opening, the new and improved Bachmann campaign. And I'm kind of expecting to have that, a number of times as we move forward. So that should be quite the interesting show, if you will. Anyway. I'm sorry. I just can't get that out of my head. How Michelle Bachmann and Palin? Maybe it's because they look alike. Maybe that they kind of look alike, sisters. Is that what took you? Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after that.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
David Koch, the right-wing multi-billionaire, likes to pose as a class act. He's thrown around several million bucks, for example, to get a wing of Manhattan's Lincoln Center named for him and to buy a seat on the board of WGBH, Boston's prestigious public television station. These purchases make nice wallpaper for him, but they can't cover up the ugliness at the core of Koch's heart. He's poured a fortune and his very soul into the creation of dozens of political attack groups and corporate fronts to advance his self-serving plutocratic vision of America. Far from a class act, the Koch operation is as crass as they come. One of the crudest arms of his vast and secretive political network is called Americans for Prosperity. It runs all sorts of astroturf campaigns to knock down the prosperity of working families and lift up the power and prosperity of corporate elites, like the Kochs. AFP's Michigan branch recently showed what it's made of in a campaign to kill funding for a new international bridge between Detroit and Canada. Building this bridge would create jobs and ease traffic snarls, but it would compete with a corporate-owned toll bridge, and the Kochs virulently oppose all things public. To stir up public opposition, AFP went into a hard-hit Detroit neighborhood and plastered people's homes with official-looking flyers that declared in bold type, "Eviction Notice." The bogus flyers told homeowners that the State Transportation Agency was prepared to seize their homes to make way for the new bridge. "It was meant to startle people," said AFP's clueless and classless state director, who was perversely proud of the panic his lie had caused in this distressed community. This is Jim Hightower saying, such sensitivity is what has made the Koch name a cuss word all across America.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Modernizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Show 1-888-520-RICK 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download it at our site at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. The National Labor Relations Board, they're going to publish some new rules in the Federal Registry, a notice of proposed rulemaking, which proposes amendments to its existing rules and regulations governing procedures in representation cases. According to their press release, the proposed amendments are intended to reduce unnecessary litigation, streamline pre- and post-election procedures, and facilitate the use of electronic communications and document filing. Some of the things that they want to do is they want to allow the electronic filing of elections, their petitions, and other documents. They want to ensure that employees, employers, and unions receive and exchange information in a timely manner so that they get what they need to understand and to participate in the process. They're going to standardize the timeline for parties to resolve or to litigate issues before and after elections. They're going to require parties to identify issues and describe evidence soon after the election petition is filed to facilitate resolution and eliminate unnecessary litigation. They're going to defer litigation of most voter eligibility issues until after the election, require employers to provide a final vote list in electronic form soon after scheduling an election, including voters' telephone numbers and email addresses when available. They're also going to consolidate all election-related appeals to the board into a single post-election appeals process, and therefore eliminating the delay in holding elections currently attributable to the possibilities of pre-election appeals. And they're going to make the board review of post-election decisions discretionary rather than mandatory. And you look at this, and there's some very common sense points here. You're gonna uphold the right to the vote. I know everybody was crazy about the Employee Free Choice Act stealing the right of the ballot box, which it didn't do, but there were some out there who kept pushing that. If people wanted to have a secret ballot election, there would be a secret ballot election. That was up to the workers, not to the company. They still have the ability today to bypass the ballot box, which is what most of the crazies on the right don't want you to hear. But this is going to say, you know what, you've got the basic right. We're going to hold the same thing. The rule, you know, takes away some of the obstacles. What it's going to do is it's going to shorten some of the times maybe. Hopefully we get things in a more timely fashion, get rid of some of the excessive delays, maybe some of the litigation. Because, you know, getting rid of this is good for, I think, everybody. I mean, who wants to spend all their time fighting this? I mean, that Rite Aid thing. In Lancaster, California, 5 years of back and forth fighting. Who's that good for? Did the company win out? Did they get anything out of it? I would argue no. And I think what some of these rule changes are going to do, help us rebuild the middle class. If you remember right after Obama took office, the first thing I said he should have done was pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Give people the opportunity to collectively bargain, give people the opportunity to demand some of the wages, some of the benefits, some of the profits that they're creating. I mean, here's the reality. You look at Wall Street. You look at the boardrooms. You look at these CEOs. They're all doing well. Their pockets are full. Their coffers are lined, man. Who's struggling? You are. I am. Families across this state, across this country, struggling. We've got governors like the folks in Wisconsin who are saying, sorry, you lazy unemployed people, we're not going to go after the federal funding that could help you sustain for several more weeks. Here in Pennsylvania, we had Republicans who were saying, yeah, we're going to let you do it, but we need a pound of flesh first. Fortunately, there were a number of Republicans here in Pennsylvania who said, wait a minute, we're not going to go that far. And the reality is that any opposition to people collectively bargaining is purely politics by the right wing. I mean, listen to them scream and whine and complain and, oh, my goodness, you would think that these rule changes were the end of the world. And all they are is streamlining the process that's already in place, making it fairer for both sides, making it faster for both sides. See, but here's the point. The employers don't want it modernized. They don't want it standardized. They don't want they like the loopholes right where they are. Why? Because they can, of course, they can manipulate them. Just like they did 5 years. Can you believe that? 5 years. You have the right in this country to organize. You have the right to join a union. You have the right of association. 5 years it took for them to get their first contract. 5 years. That to me is just absolutely, absolutely amazing. Anyway, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I don't know if you saw this. Carl Eikenberry. He is the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and a former military commander. You remember not too long ago you had Hamid Karzai, the president there of Kabul, the mayor of Kabul, if you will, who basically said that the U.S. and NATO were occupiers and at some point they were probably going to be asked to leave. Well, Eikenberry had an interesting comment at the Herat University there. A warning, if you will. He said, quote, when we hear ourselves being called occupiers or worse and our generous aid programs dismissed as totally ineffective and the source of all corruption, our pride is offended and we begin to lose our inspiration to carry on. Now, I mean, that's kind of a veiled threat to saying, you know what, if you don't want us here, we're going to leave and you're going to let us collapse. I'm saying, don't wait. They don't want us there. Time to gather the sheep and get the flock out. And you look at what we talked about yesterday. $18 billion of money gone in Iraq, gone, on skids. Who knows where it went? You look at all this money, $113 billion we're going to be pouring into Afghanistan this year. And yet, what are we doing? We're talking about cutting Medicare. We're talking about cutting Social Security. We're talking about slashing education, kicking people off the unemployment rolls. We're talking about all these negative things. You know what? That $113 billion could do an awful lot right here at home. Yet, sorry. So the president said, you know, he's expected to say tomorrow that they're going to draw down some troops, about 10,000 maybe, by the end of the year. They're talking about bringing some of the 30,000 home by the end of 2012. And I'm looking at this going, really? We're going to keep spending all of this resource for what? To make big rocks small.
Well, I think when you look at it, and I was one who thought that we had legitimate reasons for going in there initially, and if we would have done it right, which the Bush administration initially proposed, I think we could have probably cut the head off.
Could have probably.
Could have, but that was a long time ago. We blew that. I think the best thing we can do, and I do think that we should give them aid once we're out of there, but what we need to do, you're not going to eliminate Al-Qaeda. You're not going to kill them all. Not going to happen. What we need to do is, at the end of the day, the Afghani people are going to have to make this choice. So what should we do? I think the best thing we can do is offer money as far as improving infrastructure, improving their life. Give them an opportunity for all their people or as many people as possible to get an education. In other words, make a difference as far as our aid, but as far as militarily. We should have learned a lesson from history. There has been no power that has really conquered Afghanistan, and that's just the way it is.
Those people do not want us there. They have lived for thousands of years without our help. They will go on for thousands of years more. Gather the sheep. Get the flock out.
And the only hope is that we provide them with the opportunity to make their life better and to see that, look, there is a better way than Al-Qaeda's way. That's the only way we can change them.
It's just nuts. Anyway, another U.S. Supreme Court ruling yesterday that caught my attention that basically states that states don't have to automatically They don't have the automatic duty to provide counsel in civil court cases. The case of this guy who, a divorced father, he was going to go to jail because he failed to pay child support. 5-4 decision. Surprise, surprise. The justices found that while the South Carolina, the father's rights had been violated because he was not given free counsel, they said the U.S. states did not have to pay. The U.S. states did not have to pay to provide such advice in all civil contempt cases. The case was being highly watched, and what they're saying has been emblematic of what civil rights groups have called a trend toward debtor's prison in America. And it made me stop and think, what happens if you get yourself into debt? What happens if you get called into court, especially with this whole child support thing? What if you just don't have the money? And now you're being called into court, a civil court, yes, that has the ability to toss you in prison. What happens? Do you then have the right of the Fifth Amendment? Do you have all of those things? This guy, and I understand, this guy was his fifth infraction. The family court sentenced him to 6 months in jail. He was released when he was, I think it was like almost $6,000 behind in his child support. And then he was sentenced to 12 months in jail. So, what if the guy doesn't have a job? And in this whole case, he wasn't given access to counsel. And look, if you don't have money to pay child support, who's gonna have money to pay for an attorney? Now, I'm not one to say that he shouldn't be paying child support. That's not what I'm saying. But at the end of the day, if you're gonna go to jail, if something, I think you should have the right to at least speak to a lawyer. Don't you think?
Well, I think don't they have public defenders?
Not
in civil court. There's nobody.
No.
Wow.
Which is kind of where this case was taking us. Anyway, let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK right back after this.
This is why we fight, why we lie away. This is why.
For the rest of us, Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseccu.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Number check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. That'll find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. Our good friend Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Alan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
It seems Health and Human Services has finally decided to do something about the ads on cigarette packs.
Well, they certainly have, and in fact, they are actually working with the Ad Council. They're working with other groups. They've put very scary looking ads on the packs, and they're hoping that it cuts down on smoking. Kathleen Sebelius, who's the Secretary of HHS, said today at the White House that in fact, and I was actually at a restaurant with her the other night, she said that, not with her, at the same restaurant, and she said that one out of every that they have 200 billion dollars a year, not 200,000, 200 billion dollars a year, Rick, are lost for productivity, because of illness due to smoking.
But is this the, I looked at the pictures and I go, okay, you know, they're kind of scary, but, is this gonna do it? I mean, at this point, don't we know that smoking is going to kill you?
Well, we do, but the question is the issue is trying to get people to stop really before it really hits them, if you know what I'm saying.
How about big letters? This will kill you.
That is good, and in fact, actually, in parts of Europe, they do have this will kill you pretty
skull
much.
And crossbones, something. This will kill you, unquestioningly. Just amazing stuff. The presidential field heating up. I see Huntsman's.
Mr. Huntsman is back in the mix here.
In the hunt.
And he is, it is actually the person, even though a lot of people don't think he can raise the money that Mitt Romney can, they're the candidate the White House is most afraid of in terms of his ability to sort of look moderate and not seem like a crazy.
Well, and look moderate while still being crazy.
Because
some of the things that he stands for during his time in Utah, his budget deficits went through the roof.
Right, which is why he's going to have a very hard time sort of looking in a different kind of way to the Republicans. And that's probably why he's not going to get elected. But he, in terms of a general election, he would be one of the most scary characters for the Obama people to get there, but my guess is he's probably not going to get there.
Well, I don't think he's going to get there because he's like all the rest of them. He's very homogenous. Same, cut all the corporate tax, hand out money to the very wealthy. Basically the same, and Medicare, same kind of Republican. Nothing new there.
Right.
At least not to me anyway.
No. He's very, very, he is the same kind of Republican, but he looks more moderate. And in a general election, but you know, those are not the people that get the vote of the party. In general, people in the Republican Party vote to the right.
Right. And I'll tell you the thing that really scares me about him. That whole ambassador thing over there to China. That cozy relationship. I'm not so thrilled about that.
Well, George Bush, same guy, right?
Yeah, well, you know, still, I don't care
exactly.
Who it is. That whole cozy relationship makes me very uncomfortable. Anyway, the president's going to give a speech tomorrow.
The president is going to give a speech tomorrow. It is his sixth speech. It is not from the. It is not. Well, we don't know whether it's going to be from the Oval Office, but it's his sixth primetime speech, and so that is going to be the big event tomorrow. We'll see what happens on that front. We're expected that there's going to be a 10,000 person drawdown of the 30,000 people for the Afghanistan surge, and then what happens out of that, we don't know, but 30,000 people over the next year, we think.
Right. If it were me, and I go back to this, I think the president should have been giving more of these speeches. Right when he came into office, he was doing it pretty regularly. And as I've been saying for the longest time, I think he got rabbit ears. The Republicans were beating him up for, you know, going out and talking to the American people. And he kind of recessed back. And that's when they were able to take control of the message and really turn toward them.
Well, yeah. And I think that it'll be interesting. I mean, I just think this is the Romney fight with Huntsman is going to be something. Get out the popcorn.
Yeah. Well, you don't think Huntsman will miss the opportunity that Pawlenty did when the Seven Dwarfs had their debate last week?
You know, it's really hard to say what he's going to be doing, but we also know, for instance, the McCain's Finance Committee quit, and then you've got Rick Perry being urged to run.
Yeah, that's going to be the interesting one. Because what harm could a governor from Texas do? Anyway, in talking about...
Let's not even go there.
We won't. In talking about the drawdown, in Afghanistan, today, Senator Kerry and Senator McCain talking about something on Libya?
That's right. What they're saying is that the president should actually have one year on this Libyan issue, that he should be allowed to do what he wants for 1 year before going to Congress, and they're trying to pass a bill, and it's Kerry and McCain on that.
Oh, boy. A whole year. Good, good, good. Nice.
Can you imagine?
And lastly, finally, the Senate actually confirmed somebody?
Yes, it was 100% by the Senate, Leon Panetta.
Well, there you go. And what will Leon be doing?
Well, he's going to be running the Defense Department, and he's going to be obviously connecting with all his little CIA contacts.
How wonderful. And a whole year in Libya, lots of mischief we can...
Beyond mischief, and a lot of cost. We're fighting three wars over there.
Yeah, but we can't give people health care. Like that story of the guy yesterday robbed a bank for a dollar just so he could get health care.
Did you see him on TV? He was really quite amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there are people, and I'm expecting to see more of that because he got the health care that he needed. He got an exam, and they found, whatever it is they needed to find. I'm expecting more people to do it. I'd do it if I were in that situation. What do you got to lose at that point?
You've got nothing to lose, and it was clear he had nothing to lose, and he only asked for a dollar.
Yep. Ellen Ratner, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. And now to find out what's going on across the street, what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, Rick, there's a press release issued by the executive director of the Alliance for Retired Americans. If you remember, the AARP had come out recently and said under certain conditions, we would be willing to accept some cutbacks and benefits depending on the total situation and what givebacks were also given by the other side. The executive director of the Alliance for Retired Americans has kind of come out with a press release stating their position. This is his press release. The story in the Wall Street Journal today, this is a quote, the story in the Wall Street Journal today, which states that AARP supports cutting Social Security benefits, makes it apparent to me that AARP is not representing their members on this issue. I will leave it to AARP's members to decide how they feel about this. AARP does not speak for all citizens, and on this topic, probably not for many of their own members. We are against Social Security cuts for seniors. Our members hope that the AARP will answer directly some basic questions. Do you support any cuts in benefits? Do you support raising the retirement age? Do you support means testing? These are questions that any senior organization ought to be prepared to answer directly. The Alliance for Retired Americans has fought side by side with AARP on many issues in the past, but if the story in today's Wall Street Journal is accurate, we will be parting company on this issue because we can't let seniors down. And, Rick, I agree with this organization's retort to AARP 100%.
Well, what organization was it?
Alliance for Retired Americans, a labor organization. AARP on another issue, if you remember, going back to 2005 on that prescription drug. I know there were a lot of people upset, and I was one of them. I know that some people actually got out of the AARP when they agreed to put their name to that bill that basically gouged seniors on the prescription drug within Medicare. I think they made a mistake there, and I think they make a mistake here. I think what Democrats have to do, and organizations like AARP, the Alliance for Retired Americans, and the Alliance for Retired Americans have it right. I think what we have to do is draw a line in the sand and say, when it comes to entitlements, we will not even talk about giving back until you people address the issue of income into the national treasury, talking about billions of dollars of subsidies to corporations. We're also talking about tax breaks to the rich. You do something about that, then maybe we'll talk about it. Until then, we don't even want to hear about it. And when the AARP comes out and says, well, we'd be willing, I think from day one, what you're doing is giving our opposition something that they don't necessarily have a right to have.
Well, you're moving the goalposts.
Exactly
and
right.
As Democrats
and
keep
you
doing.
You said it well.
You keep moving the goalposts. And we keep, and we've been doing this for 30 years. We've been moving steadily, marching towards the right, while the right is sprinting to the extreme. Because we have to compromise, because we're the party of surrender, evidently. And we keep giving, and they keep asking. At some point, you have to draw the line in the sand, as you said. And look, I don't look at Social Security and Medicare as entitlements. That's right-wing language. These are things that people paid into. These are things that we've decided that we need. And these are benefits that we have paid into our entire lives. And they should be there. Because it makes it sound like it's, it's something that you're given. No, you weren't given this. Paid for it. It's a society we paid for. And we need to make sure that the people who stole the money, because remember, Social Security is in trouble. Why? Because there are filing cabinets full of IOUs. And those IOUs, they don't want to pay back. That's what this is about.
Sometimes I think psychologically the Republicans have just been so intransigent that Democrats say, well, you know, we don't want to be like them. And they're too quick to compromise. Look, I understand that politics is the art of compromise. But there are some things that are just...
No, politics is the art of possible. The art of what is possible.
Call it what you want. And the possible usually has the ingredient of compromise. You can call it what you want, but here's the bottom line. There are certain things that you don't compromise on, and that's taking care of our senior citizens.
And the Republicans
and first and foremost is Social Security.
And the Republicans have said we're not going to compromise on our core principles. We're not going to compromise on anything. We're just like two-year-olds with our fingers in our ears, and we're going to kick and scream until we get our way.
Well, guess what, Republicans? You're not in control.
Actually, they're in control of the House.
However, sometimes I think that the Democrats are compromising when they don't have to. Here's the thing. It has to be agreed to. You know, to balance a budget, it has to be agreed to. That means Democrats have to agree.
But again, you've got one party, and this is where I think you're maybe not seeing the big picture. You've got one party that really doesn't give a rat's behind about this country. They've had a scorched earth mentality for the better part of 30 years. They don't care. They're going to be fine. Their constituents, the upper crust, going to be fine. You working people, you stiffs down at the bottom, you're the one who are going to pay the price. Look at this collapse from 2008. Look at September 2008. Who's doing really, really well? And who's not? And look who the Republican Party is pandering to, and look who they're not.
So the Democrats draw the line on Social Security, let the Republicans draw the line on they won't reduce taxes for the corporations on the rich, and we'll let the people in 2012 decide. I'm willing to do that.
See, but here's the problem. You've got this debt ceiling problem. You've got this ability of countries around the world to call in our debt, raising interest rates, costing us billions more in interest payments. You've got this looming crisis. And if you've got one party that doesn't care and they've got this scorched earth mentality, how do you negotiate with that? How do you come to an agreement with one party who just does not care?
Chris Van Hollen was on TV today on a national show. And this is not Social Security, it's Medicare. But he said, look, behind the scenes, we're engaged right now into some tough discussions with the Republicans. But we are talking about certain things like in Medicare, one way to reduce cost. Let's look at the situation with the prescription drugs. Let's look at that. And that's one area where maybe we can find common ground. There are ways to find common ground, but you got to negotiate, and you got to negotiate tough. And you can't, prior to really coming to a definitive decision, you can't give away the house right away. Although maybe that's not fair.
But you're starting, it's
a little bit like health care with the president. Instead of the president saying to Congress, this is exactly what I want, boom, boom, and boom, what did the president say? Give me health care. And he threw away the high ground. And I think that's what the AARP just did. They gave away the high ground. And strategically, I think they lost that. Another report coming out of Harrisburg Mayor Linda Thompson, who's been the focal point of, and you know, just an avalanche of criticism. I don't know. Now, there's people resigning or who are saying, look, she demands that we go to prayer meetings, and there's been just a hailstorm of criticism over that. Anyway, she has come out and said, look, the city should avoid bankruptcy. The fiscal Republican plan that the state-appointed Act 47 team introduced last week contains better options, according to her spokesman, Mr. Philbin. Recommendations in the plan would minimize financial pain and service cuts city taxpayers would have to endure while sharing a maximum amount of economic pain with other stakeholders, again, according to Mr. Philbin. Some city council members want to keep bankruptcy on the table to help give the city leverage in negotiation terms with other stakeholders of Harrisburg's $310 million of incinerator debt. City Councilman Brad Kublinski, who reported before, plans to introduce a resolution at council tonight. That was supposed to be at 6 p.m. That would allow the council to prepare bankruptcy papers should it decide to file for Chapter 9. The council will discuss the plan with Act 47 team at the meeting. The Act 47 team introduced its plan to council and Thompson on June 13th. The plan addresses Harrisburg's annual budget deficit and incinerator debt. Its recommendations include the sale or lease of the city's parking system, the sale of the incinerator, layoffs, wage freezes, and renegotiated union contracts. All those things, and this is the bad part, all those provisions will dramatically affect city workers in a very, very negative way, and that's the shame of all this. Either way they go, the city workers that work at the incinerator and the city workers that work for the garage are going to really, really take a big hit.
Okay, let's take a break. We're going to be right back. Sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one? Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well. Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211. How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave? Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike. Call him at 243-3211. You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too. So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings. That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair.
To turn America blue. Now let's keep it that way. The Rick Smith Show. This is the time. This is the place. For we'll move the future. There's not much left to go around. Everyone is just a land of confusion.
Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all emails personally. Before we move on, I want to thank all of our guests tonight. Rand Wilson, the guy, communications guy at the AFL-CIO in Washington. Also, Sandy McNair, a labor attorney out of Cleveland, Ohio. And, of course, Michael Etwig for the piece that he's written over at Truth Out. Great stuff there. And, of course, Carrie Axelrod from Walmart Watch. Thank them for being here. Also, you know, it's great to have our listeners and our people who you know, find it important to send us a quick email. You know, on the AARP story, Andy, you know, threw in a pretty interesting idea. You know, look, yeah. AARP doesn't represent the views of citizens over 50. Second, AARP is a shill for the insurance industry, Andy writes, and United Health Group in particular. He goes on to point out that AARP's function is to get seniors into Medicare Advantage, Part C, a benefit for health insurance industry. Again, UHG gains. Members, he says, of AARP have been duped by corporate hacks for the profit for the for-profit health insurance industry, a failed model of corruption benefits immensely off of the backs of the American citizenry. And, you know, you look at all the money that has gone to these, you know, he talks about William McGuire, Dollar Bill McGuire, who was paid over $100 million in 2005. You know, at one point, over a 10-year period, he took $1 billion. And understand, over that period, that is $1 billion in health care that you didn't get. That's $1 billion in health care that the guy who had to rob a bank to get health care couldn't get. And that's what really drives me nuts about this health care industry. They're lining their pockets, CEO profits up, they're handing it out to their boards of directors, but boy, you need health care? There's the door. Go rob a bank. Amazing stuff. Story of the Patriot News today. Penn State Dickinson School of Law. They are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to permit another appeal in a case involving military reservists. Here's the thing. You got these guys who are going off to fight in war. They're coming back and they're saying, look, you know, our employers are mistreating us. They're not following the law. They're making a hostile work environment. There's all of this stuff, and there's nobody really pushing for us. So the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals back on March 22nd rejected their case, and it was a negative decision in the Carter versus Continental Airlines suit because this guy, Daryl Carter, he was a pilot and a reservist. You know, he went off, you know, served his country, came back, found himself in a negative position, and what they're saying is some 500,000 reservists and National Guard could be affected by the same type of things. Because, you know, over the last 10 years, and can you believe it's been 10 years? I mean, stop and think about this.
Now that brings back some nightmares. Some of those reservists were called up several times. We're talking about Iraq. I mean, some of those soldiers were recycled three and even four times, and you have some horror cases, Rick, where they actually lost their homes. I mean, what is wrong with us? You go and fight, and you put your life on the line for your country, and you lose your home? What kind of country are we turning into? No. Now, I do believe maybe one exception would be if your company did business with the federal government, they might have some leverage, but other than that, wow, something needs to be done.
Absolutely. Well, and most people think we've got laws to protect them. Evidently, we don't. Evidently.
Now, ironically, some union contracts do have protection for those people. I think my union contract used to mention it.
I know the one that I used to be covered by did. I know the National Master Freight Agreement absolutely had language in there. And again, you know, it comes back down to this. Do you have a voice where you go to work? Unfortunately, the vast majority of people don't, so they've gotten used to the beatings. They've gotten used to being taken advantage of.
And I guess my question is, where's the Republican Party?
Free market.
Where's the Republican
Party? Free market.
They love the troops. They just love the troops.
Well, it's good to take a picture.
When they want to run for re-election.
You got to love the picture. On Friday, mark this on your calendar. Friday's big day. It's take your dog to work day. Pet Sitters International a company based out of North Carolina. They want businesses to open their doors, so workers can bring their best friend to work with them. And I'm looking at this going, this is really a dumb idea. Do we have nothing better to do? But evidently, they've been doing this since 1999. Beth Stoltz, the spokesperson for the group, said it began way back then, and they've had it a yearly event ever since. And listen to this quote. She says, quote, "It was created as a way to give back to the pet community." A way to give back to the pet community, to experience, to really celebrate the companions dogs make. This woman needs to get a life. She's probably as off the rocker as this woman, who New York officials say they arrested because she threatened a Little League coach that didn't keep her son on the team, sent threatening letters to this guy, and I'm going, really? You know, having coached a number of teams, you can see some people like this, but, you know, really? Threatening letters over your daughter, not making a team? Is it that important?
I have to say this. There's some males that did worse things than that, like attack the coach.
Well.
I've had people who umpire those games at the midget level and said that is absolutely the worst age to coach because the parents are the worst.
No, it's nuts. It's just fortunately this year all the parents were great. All the parents were great and appreciative that I wasn't crazy. And under the heading of who says you have to be young to be dumb or to do dumb stuff, 53-year-old Beryl Duncan, evidently, who knows why she did it, but she took the license plate off of a police car and shoved it down her pants. A witness called the police. The police came over, found her with the license plate down her pants. She told them it just fell off the car and she was holding it until the police could come for it. She was arrested and charged with criminal possession of stolen property and petty larceny.
She must be listening to Fox News. She has all these good excuses.
Really? What were you thinking there? And I'm sure something going to be a real big hit at the next Republican presidential debate and the RNC convention that we're going to be going to. A vendor in California has come up with the new creation of deep-fried Kool-Aid. So you can not only drink the Kool-Aid, you can now eat deep-fried Kool-Aid. Isn't that beautiful? Chicken Charlie Boehner, he has come up with this, this great concoction. Other creations, he has the deep-fried Klondike bar, deep-fried Pop-Tarts. So he is like one of the kings of deep-fried.
Can I ask the question, how do you deep-fry Kool-Aid?
What you do is you put it in a batter. You take the mix and you put it in a batter and you deep fry the batter. So when you eat, it's like a donut. It's like one of the donut holes.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, and that's the same thing how they do Pepsi and how they do other stuff. They make it into a batter. And they
can't wait for that.
There you go. So that'll be a big hit at the RNC convention. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests. I want to thank you. Again, you missed any portion of the show, go to RickSmithShow.com. See you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.